Detroit. Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Hi, Jolene.
Hello, Peter.
How you doing?
Oh, doing just fabulous.
Sunday
ready
night
to go.
Sunday night, 11 o'clock on the Riff. It's got to be Night Call. Been doing it for a few years.
42nd year.
God, we started when we were three.
I wasn't here. I was alive.
Yeah, that's cool. Hey, this is the phone-in talk show. It's the Riff's opportunity for you to give your opinions, express your views on the radio. It's our public service show. Take a little break from the rock and roll, which will be back at 2 a.m.
Yes.
And
with Lynn Kuhn.
In the meantime, 313-298-WRIF gets you on the air.
That's 313-298-9743. I kind of want that music to just keep going.
Okay.
Feeling good. It's feeling groovy.
Peter Gunn. Wow. You never let it go that long, do it. Hey, we got a great Facebook page going. Jolene, thank you so much. Debbie in Northampton, Massachusetts.
I couldn't do it without her, actually.
Yeah. But we've been kind of preempting her lately.
Because?
Well, because you've been so active on it.
I've been on it.
It's not a complaint.
Yeah. Well, there's certain times during my life where I'm busier than others,
yeah.
And she really picks up the slack for me, and I appreciate that.
She does indeed. And if you would like to call 313-298-WRIF, we have Athena and Sarah standing by, and they'll provide our podcast at noon tomorrow, Monday. So it's all there. Well, where do we start? You know, there was, this is all seeming like such incredibly old news that there was the Michigan primary
for
the Republicans.
Just, not even a week ago.
Yeah, last Tuesday. And, Mitt Romney won.
Yes.
Beating Rick Santorum. Of course, the really crazy conservatives, as opposed to the opportunistic conservatives like Mitt Romney, the two of them together, and that's Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich, mm-hmm. I mean, they way outpoll him. And in fact, if Gingrich would have ever pulled out, if it wasn't for this rich casino owner in Las Vegas that keeps pumping money into the Gingrich campaign, Santorum would be on his way to the nomination to be the Republican challenger Barack Obama.
Yeah, I was just thinking that this morning, well, where has old Newtster been? Haven't heard a lot about him.
In Georgia.
Okay. Yeah, I think he was on one of the morning shows. I saw something on online that he did make an appearance. He's around. He's waiting above water.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out here what I did here with my computer, but what the heck. Anyway, the big news. What's the big news? I mean, this is all being played. These Republican Gaia that these debates are over, right?
Yeah.
But still, Super Tuesday coming up this Tuesday. You know, Will Santorum. So they're playing it like some really horrible reality show. Like what's
Well, it is.
Yeah. Well, no. Is it really reality? It's sort of like some unreality. You know what the big story is? 80% of Michigan Republican voters avoided the polls.
Well, we knew that was going to
happen.
That's
the big story. 80% of people that could make a decision couldn't give up what.
Yet we hear so much about it. We're bombarded with information about it, but no one goes out and does. That's pretty lame on their part, but hey.
You know, there was a big flap in the Romney campaign, first just because of people like me that voted in the Republican primary trying to elevate the worst candidate. But then Santorum actually fielded these robocalls to Michigan Democrats asking them to vote for him. In other words, there was nobody to vote for in the Democratic presidential primary.
Can vote.
Yeah, yeah.
And
Romney said it's a dirty trick. Oh, God.
Everything any of them do is a dirty trick, pretty much.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me, because some people were saying, saying that it's really unethical to do that. For people like me.
Yeah, you've gotten some flack.
Yeah, but you know what?
I didn't do it. I just felt weird about it.
Tuesday, as I always do, I played handball, and we had, let me see, either 8 or 10 guys, all of who are left of center. We play handball. Did I say that? We play the manly art
people
of handball,
like, what's that?
As we say. Not the Olympic sport. It's like racquetball, except you don't use a racket. You use both hands. It's an older game.
Yeah.
And so I said, did any of you guys vote in the Republican primary? And they all looked at me like I was crazy.
I'm sure they did.
And that, so I explained to them, and then they went back to talking about what we always talk about.
Which is?
I don't want to say.
Okay. I can only
the waitress.
You boys.
Yeah, it's a boys' night out. Anyway, but in defense of this, this is a publicly financed primary. You and me, I pay for this damn thing. Now,
right.
I for a long time have been threatening, in fact, even talked to a lawyer buddy of mine about filing a suit saying that why in the world should me or you, who are neither, certainly not Republicans, but neither are we Democrats,
right,
why should we have to pay for these private, the selection of the candidates for these private political parties?
Why do we have to pay for so many things, this included,
yeah,
with you?
Well, the idea was, this was an anti-corruption thing, to get it out of the back rooms. I think I said this the other week. This was a Michigan statute, and I think it might happen in a lot of states, that in order to, you know, stop the party bosses from picking the candidate, and said, you get this, what do you want, the party bosses or this totally insane,
sect of the population?
No, you know, the process is pretty crazy.
Okay.
With all these ads and all that. So the idea was, if they had publicly financed primaries, that the people would get to choose rather than the party bosses. There's something to say about that.
Absolutely.
But in the main, I don't want to pay for the Republicans to pick their candidate, and
yeah,
I don't want to pay for the Democrats.
Right.
You know what it costs the state? Like $10 million.
My gosh. And
to do that.
I wonder where that money could go. Yeah.
Not certainly for to bail out some of these cities around us, right?
Right.
You know, Ron Paul won the city of Detroit in terms of the election.
Right, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, he won that. Let's see.
Yeah, he drew some big crowds.
Rick Santorum, he heard John F. Kennedy's a fellow religionist say that he believed in the separation of church and state. Wonder where he got that idea. Could have been from the Constitution. And Rick Santorum heard it, and he said it made him want to throw up.
Well, he makes me want to throw up.
What?
I think I say that every time. Oh, that guy's ridiculous.
But he also says that we're not merely engaged in a spiritual war. Maybe I was talking about this last week.
You talked a little bit about it.
Satan has his sights on the United States of America.
Well, yeah, you did talk about it because one of the results of that statement was someone calling and saying, I'm a Satanist.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So we did.
Remember?
And I was just saying how crazy these people that were on the far fringes of the right wing in this country suddenly are front and center. And did I mention, maybe I did, this guy that wouldn't, in Indiana, that he, in Fort Wayne, that he wouldn't sign this House resolution, Indiana House resolution, to support the Girl Scouts on their 100th anniversary because he said they have radical policies.
And I don't get that. Like, what are their policies?
They are so crazy.
The Girl Scouts, they just want to sell their cookies, man.
And Gingrich warns about the secular left.
Yeah, he does.
He's worried about the secular left.
He's just trying to, he's scrambling to be popular with the religious folk.
Well, but the idea that somehow this country is threatened from the secular left, you know what, conservatives? This country was founded by the secular left.
Yes, please, get it.
Those revolutionaries, they weren't conservatives, you know. Got to go through this one more time.
No, please do.
Okay. The conservatives wanted us to remain a colony of England, right? The radical revolutionaries who were secularists and wrote these secular documents protecting government, the rule of secular government against religious interference, were themselves mostly secular and also were radical revolutionaries. Then we come to slavery, and the conservatives wanted to maintain conservatives because what do they want to do? What does the word mean? They want to conserve things as they are. Radicals, they want to change things. They want to change things dramatically or extremely or what have you. Then it comes to, well, things like the vote for women, the conservatives, of course.
Yeah.
And then the for African Americans. They look, can we just have the white people vote, please? And initially, you got to remember.
Let's make sure we don't count the black people as a full person.
Well, they got 3/5.
They got it even now.
But they didn't get the vote.
Right.
Yeah. And they didn't get to choose their own last name or anything like that.
Yeah.
But the conservatives wanted to keep everything like that. And then they supported every single war, every war almost that was unnecessary in American history, right? What wars were necessary in American history other than World War II? Anybody got a clue on that? And as I always say, why did we fight in World War I? Why did we fight the Spanish-American War? Why did we fight the Mexican War? Why did we fight the Vietnam War? Right? Why did we invade Grenada and Panama? Right?
Hey, all the way to
crickets,
Iran.
Crickets.
I mean, Iraq.
Yeah.
Well, that was a mistake.
Iran's coming. So all through it. And when the labor unions wanted to say, hey, can we maybe have a fair shake? The conservatives, of course, didn't want labor unions, didn't want a middle class, didn't want a weekend, didn't want a minimum wage, all of that stuff. And on and on. And when women and gays and everybody else wanted equal rights,
then it got really crazy.
Yeah. They didn't want any of that. Because if you think about it, there is not one single thing that conservatives have ever added to this country. If you can name it, I throw this. We do this every once in a while.
I can name it. Hatred. And
no. Something
like
positive.
That. Oh, okay.
313-298-WRIF. What have conservatives ever added to this country? And some once in a while, every once in a while, someone will come up with something a little obscure.
Yeah.
But compared to wanting us to remain a colony of England, to maintain slavery, to maintain segregation, and we forgot about that. Those are Southern conservatives who happen to be, Democrats. I know that. So it's not a Democrat and Republican thing. And, Lincoln was a Republican after all. And on and on. The women's vote. Whatever you can mention, those crimes committed by conservatives throughout American history, there wouldn't even be American history if it was up to conservatives, if you think about it. And they're no different today. If you ask anybody, a centrist, somebody like, and I'm really putting him farther left than he actually is, a centrist like Barack Obama, what's wrong in this country? He would, reel off a list of things. You go to center left, and then, they add to it. You go to leftists, you go to people that are so insanely off the political spectrum to the left, like Jalene and me, and we could keep you up for the next 3 nights telling you what we'd like to see positive. Maybe you don't agree with a single thing we say, but we see a host of problems and would suggest ameliorations, problems, solutions, and what have you. The conservatives think there is one thing wrong with this country. Liberals exist.
Oh, yeah.
That's it.
They're terrified.
Yeah, that's it. That's what's wrong with this country. Everything would be okay exactly as it is. Well, I mean, no, I shouldn't say that. They would roll back things.
They would change a lot of things.
They would have
their way.
Prayer in school, and they would have no abortions and on and on like that. No contraception, right? Now they've even gone that far. So,
it's been a busy week for that subject, but we'll get to that.
We can do that because Oscar Wilde, the great satirist and playwright of the late 19th century in England, we had the most quotable guy on the planet almost, but he said, the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about. So I'll tell you a brief little story that...
Were you talked about?
Talked about, I've been buked and I've been scorned. I've been talked about sure as you're born. So this was in the late 90s, and one of, I don't even know what kind of format they have now, but one of these FMers tried to come up against WRIF with a rock format and didn't work. So they went to all conservative talk on FM. And it just bombed beyond belief.
Like quickly?
But they had that crazy woman who's a lawyer, that we don't ever want to mention her name.
That ass crazy.
Yeah. She's, and that's the thing. So, I was in Ann Arbor. And, so I'm driving home. It's about, 11 o'clock at night or something like that. And I'll say, I wonder what old BS. I mean, that's both bat and bull, right? Crazy lady is talking about
to.
I must have told you this story, right?
I know the story because I had arrived in I was in your world at this time.
Okay, so I punched the button into that station, and the first two words I hear coming out of there is, this is another station, Peter Warby. I go, whoa, what? I go, and I thought maybe I'd hit riff, and they were doing some
promotion or something.
And no, it's this crazy lady and her whack job callers ripping me a new one.
Fabulous.
Right. He's such a hypocrite. He always says he's such an environmentalist, and he's flying all over the world. We're using up jet fuel. And he works for a big corporation. And I can't even remember.
Rabid against the word.
So what do you think my reaction was? I had a smile broad. I thought my face was going to break.
Yeah, right.
Because there's a couple of things. One, you have a prominence. You know, this is, I know, little fish in a, or what is a big fish in a little pond?
Okay.
You know, I'm not, you know. I don't know,
Peter.
Yeah. I mean, given the talk world and all that. But anyway. Yeah. And then the callers, they're piling on. So first off, you have to have some public recognition,
to
right?
be talked about.
Yeah. I mean, who, you know, if they started talking about, I don't know, I can't even see a name here somewhere. But, I'm trying to think of some obscure, but anyway, you have to be known. So I figure I got to call in. I'm going to call in. I'm going to say, hey,
it's Peter.
It's me. I couldn't. The lines were so busy
you
with people denouncing me. Right. So one of the things that Jalene and I never do is we never give free publicity to these right wing crazies.
We try not to.
They get enough. And what do we used to call, you know, the tall, thin woman with the blonde hair, but we don't want to say her name. We used to call her, was it T-A-W, that awful woman, or the T-A-P, that awful person. So we didn't want to, you know, people would know who she was, but we didn't want to give her anything. You know where this is all going, right? We're going to talk about Rush Limbaugh.
Right.
Yeah. Who is risen for some reason. I mean, who organizes essentially as an audience the third of the population that are these extraordinarily angry white men, right?
They love Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah. So he never gets extraordinary ratings, but he gets enough because, most of us white guys are pretty nice and pretty tolerant and pretty loving and understanding and know, even older white guys know the world has changed a lot from when they or we were kids and all that. And come on, you know, give up the nonsense and the stuff that never worked then.
Evolve already.
Yeah, evolve, and it doesn't work now. But what he did, and actually, I mean, that if there's an official, I don't know what you'd call it, official social policy ideology or whatever for this country, it is one of liberalism. That is not even so much, not certainly in economic policy, definitely not in foreign policy at all. But what is happening is the realization of the American Revolution. It began with, you know, the vote only being available to propertied white males, right? So it's been a, whatever we're at now, 200 and whatever year struggle for inclusion so that nobody's excluded.
For everybody else.
Yeah, everybody else gets to come in. Doesn't matter your gender, your color, your sexual orientation. Yeah. I'm not saying those battles are won, but that's where we are. Well, the guys, and there are some women, there are a lot of crazy women out there too, but it's mostly resides among men. I'd say that's true.
I agree.
That's true. And what Rush does is give them permission to continue these old prejudices.
Yeah, right.
These old resentments that, and plus, what I always say, they are psychoanalytic chicken, which is the, the third word. What was it? Batch, bullsh, and psychoanalytic. And what I mean by that is these big tough guys that talk real tough and all that, support every war and, you know, and all that. They really don't have the courage to face their masters, the rulers. So what that is, and this is the typical authoritarian personality, it's the building block of a fascist personality and a fascist movement. And you see all sorts of signs of this in what's going on within the Republican Party, is that they really are crazed by what's going on. I mean, it's this tremendous fear.
That's what it is.
Yeah, and listen, we're all facing this insecurity, and that's one reaction to it. The real reaction to it would make any sense is what people have done throughout the history of this country is confront the people that are responsible for it. And it's not the people below you. It's not people of another color, another gender, another religion, or another, certainly not a sexual orientation. It's the people that are bandits, and hence they are bandits. They're making out like bandits. They're the banksters. They're the financiers. They're the big corporate guys. They're the ones that are responsible for everything bad that's happening to you.
Yeah. Yet they look at anyone, people who make less money than them or anyone who's different from them as, you know, lower than them somehow on so many levels. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we got an email. Oh, yeah. This is Maribel. She's listening in Kansas on internet radio. And she says, why is there a war on women in the U.S.? This brings us back to Rush.
Yeah.
Power must be awfully attractive for men to want to grind women down so thoroughly and humiliatingly. I'm referencing, I got through too many big words in here, Maribel.
I'm referencing
women's health, contraception, abortion, etc. What's going on and why is it going on? Well, I spoke to a little of it. But also, I mean, here, let's get back to this Rush Limbaugh thing.
Well, people might not know what it's about. And basically what he did was attacked on the air a student from Georgetown University. Law student. And she went in front of Congress and talked about reproductive rights.
Yeah, this bill that was before Congress that would not only allow employers to not offer contraceptive insurance to people, but also anything they found morally objectionable, like HIV tests or cervical cancer tests.
And once again,
completely insane.
It really is a war on women's reproductive rights and women's health care in general, in my opinion. So what he did was come back. And he called her a slut and a prostitute and said she wants to be paid to have sex. And then he said she was having so much sex, it's amazing she can still walk.
And she said she's having so much sex, she can't afford the contraception.
Right.
You know what?
She said that.
I mean, this guy is such a repellent piece of same word.
Crap.
Yeah, crap. But you know what? That's not what is as shocking as the fact that that resonates again with this one third. And this guy is so 1950s. This is back in a time, you know, one of the things that really gave it away. I was listening to our pal Tom Hartman,
mm-hmm.
and he was quoting the things that Rush Limbaugh had said about Sandra Fluke. And her name is Fluke. So obviously the E on the end makes it a long U.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept calling her Fluck.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, he has to do that because he's such an...
This is sex as dirty. This is doing the dirty deed, doing the nasty. She's a whore. She's a slut. Tom Hartman. So he was reading some of the things that that Limbaugh said about Sandra Fluke, and he said she had round heels and Hartman incredulously said, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You don't know what it means either?
No.
Well, it means that she just rolls right over, she will want to have a lot of sex.
Wow.
I mean, that's like a 19...
He is so awful.
You know what? I'm not so much... I mean, he's 100%
off.
He's 135% awful.
Yeah.
But round heels, I mean, it's like I'm surprised he didn't say that she's shacking up with guys, you know, or called her a dame. You know, this is
those would be a little bit nicer.
Yeah, this is the whore and virgin syndrome, where nice, good, upstanding guys that are, what, drug addicts like Rush Limbaugh have been married 3 or 4 times and never had any kids and what have you. But these are the kind of, they want a virgin for a wife, but, oh, they love those whores. They just want to, you know, like that. And so... in other words, they would like to have. Can I say the L word? Can I say that? Do you say that on the air?
What?
Yeah. Yeah, they want to get laid as much as I got a job. Is the hotline ring? No, I think you'd say that as much as possible because a real man has, you know,
that's right.
How many sexual partners? But a woman does it, and she then is a slut, a prostitute, and what have you.
Oh yeah,
you know what I say? if she's having, what did he say, that she's having so much sex, you know, what for one thing, none of my business and certainly none of yours,
right.
Rush. Yeah. And it wasn't, and he kept saying this was going to be a new welfare program, just another lie, and the man is extremely smart. He knows it's a lie. This was nothing that the government was going to pay for. Private insurance companies were going to pay for this.
I mean, they're just making up all this stuff, and he's just despicable.
Yeah. So
then what happens? So then there was a backlash to this.
Oh, I forgot about that. Go ahead.
Now there have been seven different companies who have pulled their advertising from the Rush Limbaugh program, including Quicken Loans from right here in Michigan. Yay. Yep. Mattress retailers Sleep Train and Sleep Number. Software maker Citrix Systems. Carbonite, which is an online data backup and online legal document services. LegalZoom, ProFlowers just did the same thing. And so he weakly, very weakly, apologized. Yeah. And he did it quietly on his website. So, you know, he just kind of snuck it in there. And, you know, so he's done the little apology, which he really isn't sorry for.
But here's the deal.
We all know that.
All it's going to do is pump up his ratings.
I know.
If he doesn't have any, you know, what happened to that truly insane man, Glenn Beck?
Yeah.
He lost all of his advertisers,
yeah.
So he was popular as hell with the crazies, but didn't have anybody to pay the bills.
You know, I don't often wish for bad things for people, but I would love to see that happen to Rush.
Well, I have to say, and I think that when I say this, I think you'll agree, I don't like to see, I mean, advertisers can do whatever they want, but the idea, for instance,
content and advertising.
Yeah, because
right. I hear you.
They, you know, well, like, a lot of companies, a lot of the car companies have a no Rush, no Howard, you know, Howard Stern, policy.
Right.
That, you know, like Ford is not going to advertise on Howard Stern's show. They're not going to advertise on Rush Limbaugh because they don't want the flack. They don't want somebody calling it, you know, I was going to buy a Fusion, but I know you're, you know, like that.
Because it will happen.
But, the idea that, that someone can be, made or broken because of, in a sense, in a way that, well, it didn't quite happen to us with our national show. That was more almost the stations themselves.
Yes.
But they were getting threats in the different cities where
they were.
From advertisers. What I'd like to see is that people just find the content so repellent. Is the man so hurtful to the whole community?
Yeah.
The whole community. And, you know, in Montana, the chief federal judge in Montana has apologized for forwarding to some of his friends an email with a racist joke about President Obama. This is a federal jurist. And you want to bet it wasn't Clinton that appointed him, that it was either Pappy Bush or Reagan or somebody like that?
I'd be willing to.
Yeah, because, again, this is the same kind of guys, the old guys, you know, that that make all these incredibly sexist remarks and call women that are sexually active round-heeled. And
my God, I've never heard that.
Yeah.
That is so...
She's got round heels. She's always shacking up with some guy. You know, dude. Dude,
so
this
laughable.
Is 2012, you know.
Get with it.
Yeah.
They're disgusting.
Yeah.
Someone wrote in, it was Kim who wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com, where you too can email us if you wish. Said the pervert also said he wanted to see the videos of her having sex if he has to pay for her birth control. Of course he does.
Well, you know, listen.
Can you imagine the porn that goes through his computer?
Yeah, but you know that he is a brilliant broadcaster. So the more outrageous things he says, can you imagine that in terms that if we weren't such layabouts and actually had some ambition, that and imagine how we would feel if the entire country was talking about us? That's what I was talking, the Oscar Wilde quote about the only thing worse than not being than being talked about is not being talked about. Look at this headline here in Yahoo. Limbaugh comments overshadow Republican contest.
Wow. Here's that is truly amazing.
One multimillionaire representative of the 1% that says, you know, a bunch of really offensive and stupid things, and it overshadows that. Now, what do you say? Why are you talking about it? Because it's about attitudes, and I don't care about him. He is a twistoid of the first order. And if you're buying into that, I care about you. I mean, the listeners. I care about ordinary people that get so twisted and turned around by the lies and the manipulation and the fear that people like him put into people. That you're because what he's doing, since he's a multimillionaire, what did he get, like $250 million for his 10-year contract? I would have done that slot for like half that.
Easily,
yeah, yeah. That he protects. He's in the 1%, and he protects the 1%. But he does it behind a smokescreen of this sort of social resentment against feminazis and gays and African Americans and Mexicans and people.
He gets away
like
with
that.
It. That's what's so incredible.
Yeah,
he gets away with it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's take a break, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. I've got Richard and Susie waiting so far.
We had a couple other callers who gave up, so call back. Yeah, we're going to open up the phone lines, 313-298-9743.
Let me see. What can I? Oh, yeah, yeah. I want to one more thing about politics when I come back, too. If you've seen any of these little election gatherings with Romney or Santorum.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're usually, what did Romney had really big one. Remember, he had 1,200 people at Ford Field that holds 65,000?
Yeah.
Ron Paul spoke up at my old alma mater, Michigan State, and drew thousands.
I know.
And I'll tell you what we think about that when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Bonus round time. If you can't teach an old dog new tricks, what can you teach him?
Conversational French?
Correct. Gingerbread men are...
Gingerbread boys, all grown up.
Correct. True or false? Netflix lets you watch movies instantly through your game console or other devices.
Duh, true.
Correct! Watch unlimited TV episodes and movies for only $8 a month from Netflix. See terms of use.
Hey, did I just win that new car over there?
No, I did.
Are you over the age of 25 and need to lose more than 30 pounds? If so, the next 30 seconds are crucial to your well-being because Sensa is sending 30-day free trials to anyone looking to lose the max amount of weight. To experience the most dramatic weight loss results, you must want to lose over 30 pounds. Call 1-800-964-4256 now. Due to overwhelming demand, there is a strict limit of one free trial per household. 1-800-964-4256. 1-800-964-4256.
Detroit Rock Station. On the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com.
Made a lipstick plastic and paint. Don't you see the
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. And check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall.
Please do it. Yeah.
Actually, let me read this one email here from Jim at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Here we go again, he says. A Democrat in the White House before an upcoming election, and up goes the price of gas. There must be a way that I can make money on this if I knew how to invest in financial bets. It's as predictable as the sun coming up. What he's talking about is the Saudis love the Republicans. Remember, they were holding hands with George Bush and everything. And the other thing
didn't
is...
Didn't they kiss or something, too?
I don't know. Could be. But we can tell we're going to get gouged again, because if the prices went up correspondingly at the pump to what the price of the barrel head was, the companies, the gas and oil companies, wouldn't make any more money than they're making now. But their profits always go up, so they're gouging us, and they're getting ready to do it again. All right, I'm going to tell you about the Ron Paul talk at Michigan State. However, I wonder if this could be who I think it is. Let me see if this is an old pal of mine. It's Jim and Troy. Jim, hi. Peter and Jalene, you're on the air.
Oh, hello, Mr. Werby and Jolene. How are you?
Good. It's a different Jim, though. I thought you were somebody else with the same name, but go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm not going to talk about what you're talking about, but I'm in Troy in the East Long Lake neighborhood.
Yeah?
When I need to, I'm between John R. and...
Well,
what's
the point, though?
When I need groceries, I go to Kroger's at Long Lake and Livernois.
Yeah,
very cool.
Which I know how to get to, or go to Myers, although Myers is a little further away from me.
Okay.
And I see ads about Myers saying their prices are cheaper, but their store is a little bit bigger, and I wouldn't know where everything is.
It's huge. It's a big, big store.
Yeah.
It's daunting.
And so I just go to Kroger's, although I still like to go to Myers, or if I want to get something at the hardware stores, I go to Ace, which I know how to get to.
Oh, cool.
Those brands down.
Yeah. Well, anyway, but there are stores outside that, so I've got to have everything that I've written down here. But there are stores that I want to go to, but it's hard for me to drive and look for the stores I want to go to.
You drive? You do the driving?
Yeah.
Okay.
We encourage you to branch out and find those
this?
Stores.
You know what? We got a lot of people waiting. So how about let me put you on hold, Jim, and I will have one of our phone screeners, Athena or Sarah, she'll write down the list of those stores, all right, and she'll give them to me later.
Excellent.
All right, thank you very much. So that's on line two. And why do we have line five and line six?
Because they're answering them.
No, those are on hold. I think maybe I did that, huh? No, I can't seem to release them.
Okay, I'll try.
Anyway, you want to try it first?
No, we're good.
Okay, we're good. All right, let's go to Susie in Dearborn Heights. Susie, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
I
just wanted to say that I'm a liberal and I voted in the primary too.
Yeah.
Who did you vote for? I just want Santorum off the air.
Oh.
Well, who did you vote for?
Oh, I voted for Romney.
Yeah.
Because I think he's unelectable, and I didn't want Santorum to have the slightest raindrop in hell.
I hear you. Because, Peter, what if?
You know what, Susie? The Democrats feel that the most unelectable guy would be Gingrich, but then Santorum, but Romney probably has the best chance because he has the general appearance of a human being, where the other two are, like from Mars or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, but he doesn't, he sounds like Data on Star Trek.
Yeah, he does.
He hasn't got any soul. So, eventually, I'm sure nobody will vote for him.
Was anybody critical of you because you voted in the Republican primary and you were a Democrat?
Well, they didn't know I was a Democrat. You mean the
no, like friends or family or something like that?
No.
Okay, well, because remember, I ran into a couple people, and that was what the Republicans were throwing a fit, saying the Democrats had no right to do it. And I don't know if you heard me at the beginning, but this is a publicly financed primary, and I'm paying for it, and you're paying for it, and we have every right in the world to vote in it.
Yeah, we want to know. We want to pick who's going to run against our guy.
You got it. All right, Susie, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Appreciate it. You have a good one. Here is Richard, and Richard is in Warren. Welcome, Richard. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to invite you and your thinking audience to some alternatives to this right-wing nonsense that are going on in the Detroit area.
Sure. What are they?
First, tomorrow, Dr. Jill Stein is coming in from Massachusetts. She's seeking, as part of her campaign, for the Green Party nomination for President of the United States.
Yeah, she's going to be at AJ's Music Cafe at 7 o'clock. I'm thinking about going down to that.
What are you? Are you stealing this guy's call? let him talk.
She's a cutting-edge researcher in environmental medicine, and some of her articles are used throughout the world as referenced by medical professionals. And as Jolene said, they're going to be at 7:30 at AJ's Cafe in Ferndale.
Let me ask you a question, Richard.
Sure.
So besides just announcements, we'll get some opinions. One of the arguments.
What is that noise, Peter?
I don't know what that kind of
feedbacky.
I don't know.
Tinny sound.
One of the arguments, Richard, against voting for a third party is always that you're going to help the other party. In other words, the people, if there wasn't a Green Party candidate, most of those people would probably vote for Barack Obama. So essentially, the argument is you're taking votes away from Obama. Although the answer is I'd rather vote for something I want and not get it than vote for something I don't want and get it. But what do you think? So if you vote for, and I'm, excuse my ignorance, her name is Jill
Stein.
Jill Stein. Jill Stein will probably be lucky to get 1%, 2% of the vote. But the Republicans have these machines in motion that steal elections regularly. So, I mean, even a few percentage points often can make a big difference. What's the defense of a third party?
Well, first of all, Peter, the Democrats are not clean in rigging elections and keeping Green parties off the ballot. The Democrats spent millions of dollars, along with SEIU, trying to keep Ralph Nader off the ballots by making frivolous legal challenges
right.
to his ballot access. Basically, I guess the position of the Green Party is we're living in a two-party dictatorship. They're both corporately controlled parties by the 1%, and they carry out the basic regime. What you're really voting for is one group of the slaveholders believe in beating their slaves into submission, and the other half of the slaveholders believe that we can get the slaves to work harder if we give them a little extra ration of food. But the reality is whenever the slaves try to step out of line, they're both going to squash them. And I guess that's where I'm coming from. And the Green Party is just a challenge to that two-party dictatorship, and you have to start somewhere, and it's going to take many years probably to overthrow it. It took women over 200 years to get the vote once they started. Same thing with the abolitionists. They started from the start of our country, and it took them over 150 years before they got to the point where there was enough of them to split up the old Whig Party
mm-hmm.
and create the new Republican Party and free the slaves. And basically, if you can't stomach either the Democrats or Republicans, this is the place you get to register to vote. The basic line is, I want somebody that I want to vote for, even if it's a protest vote, and I'm going to vote for the Green Party. If the Green Party wasn't there, I still wouldn't be voting for a Democrat or Republican. I'd probably be voting for a Libertarian or a Constitution or any one of the other parties because they're not part of the dictatorship.
All right, well, you had a couple other events you wanted to notice?
Yeah. For those who can't make AJ's tomorrow, Joe's going to be at Amir's in Ann Arbor at 4:30.
Okay.
And then my friends in the Zeitgeist movement are having their third annual Zeitgeist Day this Saturday from 12 to 8 at the Occupy Detroit offices at 5900 Michigan. They're into switching from a monetary-based system to a resource-based system, and they've got some interesting reworking of old socialist theories for the modern day, and people might want to come down and enjoy hands-on demonstrations and an assortment of speakers. They're going to have some interesting free vegetarian food available.
Naturally.
And so everybody's welcome to come on at
good
time.
All right, Richard, thank you very much for all that.
Lots going on. Wow.
Another place you can find out events is at my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And then if you go down the left column, there's a silhouette of the city of Detroit. Not a silhouette, a shot of the city of Detroit mm-hmm. from the Windsor side.
Skyline.
Thank you. The word I was, you know, it was... I'm losing this word, too. Searching for. But in any event, it doesn't have this on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because Richard wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com mm-hmm. and said, could I put that on my website? It was today, and I said, hey, you're a little late, dude. Call in.
Yeah. Well, and he did, and that's good.
Yeah.
You know, Facebook, social media is such a way of the world, and so I check, I post about our show on my mm-hmm. page, and sometimes during the show I get responses. And I got one here. And it said, don't forget to mention how Obama is trying to reverse 3+ years, oh, darn it, of giving Israel the cold shoulder. Care to respond?
Not even sure what he means. Who is the, he was saying he was giving Israel the cold shoulder.
Yeah. And says this is election year politics are finally feeling the heat. And I don't even know where to start with that.
No.
Obama has given so much money to Israel.
Yeah, maybe $30 billion. And there's, you know, and here you have Netanyahu saying, we can do what we want. We're a sovereign country. All right, MF, give us the money back then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't take our money. And then this person continues, and how Breitbart was murdered on the same day he was going to release videos that would have dealt a blow to Obama's reelection chances.
Oh, this is Andrew Breitbart, this horrible man that just
who died this week
at 43, probably from meanness,
for real.
And you know, in fact, if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, there's actually a link on there that I don't know if I still have that up there, that says let me check this out. Here it is, that says how Andrew Breitbart got away with his lies. I know you're not supposed to talk bad about the dead, but we talked badly about him while he was alive,
so I
don't feel. Yeah, the whole idea that that American politicians would make this pilgrimage to this, this is so weird. It says using a speech to a pro-Israel lobbying group. Is there a pro-Britain lobbying group? Is there a pro-French lobbying group? I mean, what if you had a pro-Chinese lobbying group? Well, that would be pretty weird. And so, yeah, now he's, you know, all these Republican presidential candidates are calling for a harder American line to rein in Iran's nuclear ambitions and all that. By the way, U.S. agencies see no move by Iran to build a bomb. They've said that recent assessments by American spy agencies are broadly consistent with a 2007 intelligence finding that concluded that Iran had abandoned its nuclear weapons program years earlier, according to current and former American officials. Iran just recently called nuclear arms production
A great sin,
and one of the who's ever talking here, I don't know who this. The Iranian foreign minister said the existence of nearly 23,000 nuclear weapons in the world posed the gravest threat to sustainable international security. And of those 23,000 nuclear weapons, Iran has exactly zero. Okay,
yeah.
So who represents this threat? Well, everybody that has. And if you think the Cold War may be over, but there are still nuclear missiles aimed right at the United States enough to wipe us off the map from Russia, for instance, and maybe from China as well.
Even though, remember all the hype about, that Russia was going to get rid of a bunch of their nukes. They didn't get rid of a bunch of their nukes.
Yeah. American officials who have assessed the likely Iranian responses to any attack by Israel on its nuclear program believe that Iran would retaliate by launching missiles on Israel and terrorist-style attacks on the United States civilian and military personnel overseas. Israel says it'll do what it wants, which it always does. Even though we are paying the cost to be the boss, you would never know it. I mean, we're signing the paycheck. We have $30 billion of our money going out to this belligerent country that it is in so frequent violation of UN resolutions, of international law, and what have you. It says, while evidence suggests that Iran continues to make progress towards nuclear weapons program, this is just crap. I mean, this is out of the same, newspaper.
New York Times.
They have the ability to reprocess this stuff, that they could do that. But the possibility that Israel will launch a preemptive strike has become a focus of American policymakers and is expected to be the primary topic when Prime Minister of Israel Benjamin Netanyahu meets with President Obama. Why doesn't he just say, hey, you even think about this, you're not getting any more of our paychecks.
Yeah.
You know why? Because we don't even have enough money to keep our cities going. The city that Jalene and I live in, they're talking about laying off cops now. You know, they're talking
more
about
cops.
Cutting back more services.
Yeah,
like
they already are closed on Fridays. Can't do anything with city government on Fridays.
And one of the things, why doesn't anybody do, well, wait a minute, actually, let me see if this is in here. You know, after, oh yeah, here we go, Marjorie Cohn. And I would suspect, I don't know people's ethnicity, and this doesn't wash a lot of water with people that are, as they put in here, pro-Israel. Marjorie Cohn, who I suspect, I mean, it's a common Jewish last name. She wrote the piece, Pressure Israel, Not Iran. Neocons, neoconservatives in Israel and the United States are escalating their rhetoric to prepare us for a war with Iran. You know, if you watch any of this stuff recently about, like, Downton Abbey or something, when, you know, this the results of World War One, you think, how in the world could these people agree to another war 20 years later? Well, we're not even through with our wars, and these insane people in Israel and here are already trying to ramp us up to another one.
Yeah, and all of those military contractors, and
they can't wait. There's something called Security Council Resolution 687 that ended the first Gulf War. Remember, it was supposed to be a United Nations action. It requires a weapons of mass destruction free zone in the Middle East. That means a nuclear free zone in the United States. Israel, which reportedly has an arsenal of 200 to 300 nuclear weapons, stands in violation of that resolution. Israel refuses to sign the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, thus avoiding inspections. And a recent op-ed piece in the Times said we should work towards a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, and that includes Israel. They cite a poll in which 65% of Israeli Jews think it would be best if neither Israel nor Iran had the bomb. Now, anything I say about Israel is nothing I made up out of my own mind. It's nothing. Everything that you ever hear me say comes from either Israeli or Jewish sources.
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea that there's this monolith of American Jewish opinion or Israeli opinion is just a bunch of nonsense. It's all the whack job right wingers in this country. That's who rules in Israel right now. Let me see here. Robert Nayman. Am I again correct in thinking maybe this is a Jewish American? Americans should be very concerned by the claim that the Israeli government would not warn the United States before it attacked Iran, because an Israeli attack on Iran could have grave implications for the United States.
Yeah.
Such an attack would likely be perceived in Iran as approved by the United States.
Absolutely.
The United States has armed the Israeli military, including with weapons likely to be used in such an attack. So, what really the United States should be saying is, Israel, Iran, let's come to the conference table and do two things. One, agree that that Israel is going to completely disarm itself from nuclear weapons, although the United States ought to be involved in that with all the rest of the countries, and Iran will agree to never develop any, and that is, you know, through inspections, you can make sure that doesn't happen. But they're not going to do it because the tail is wagging the dog. I mean, this is absolutely...
Well, contrary to what most people perceive about Iran, Iran's looking like the rational one here. That's the bottom line with this. They're saying that attacks, that nukes are bad.
Yeah, and they don't have any.
It's a great sin, they say.
Israel has hundreds of them.
Yeah.
And there should be, but why, what would be, you know, people say, well, Iran, they're crazy.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I'm
sometimes there
saying.
Are crazy people. I mean, if you go back, they're always using these pre-World War II analogies that, you could say, you can't have a, a peace treaty or whatever with Hitler. You know, he kept right. appeasing him, and it didn't work. I'm not talking about appeasing Iran or anybody. I'm talking about we have a verifiable nuclear-free zone, and that means that Israel has to come in compliance with international law. All right. Get some more of your calls. A couple of mics waiting. Sagan as well.
We have a couple open lines.
All right. I never did get to the Ron Paul speech at Michigan State University.
Well, let's get to it.
We'll get to it.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Yeah, I just found out why Jay always volunteers to make the office beverage run to McDonald's every day.
Why?
Seems if you buy 5 Hot McCafe beverages or premium roast coffees, the 6th one's free.
So we've been paying for ours and he's been getting his free?
Yeah.
I cannot believe Jay would do such a thing.
Think of something so genius.
Yeah.
Wish I would have thought of that.
Totally.
It's McCafe Rewards. Collect 5 stickers from any hot, medium, or large McCafe beverages or fresh brewed premium roast coffee and your 6th one is free.
Limited time offer. Effort is paid at McDonald's.
WRIF and WRIF HD 1 Detroit.
Peter and Jaleen, you're listening to Night Call, the Rift award winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, we're back. Our second hour, our phone number, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
A couple open lines for you. Some callers waiting as well. Look, I've been, all you Ron Paul supporters probably have your Kleenex box out and everything.
Oh,
so
God.
Is that bad to say?
No, I love it, actually.
Yeah, all right. Well,
makes me laugh every time.
Here are these other candidates. Fueled by millions and millions of dollars in super PAC money and all that. And Ron Paul getting, I don't think he's got any super PAC money at all. But right up on Monday, right before the Michigan primary, he was at Michigan State. He spoke for almost an hour. 3,700 people, mostly young people, got a 40-second standing ovation. People chanting, President Paul, President Paul.
Boy, 40 seconds isn't that long.
Oh, man, it really is.
I've had standing of... No, I haven't.
Yeah. Let's see, references to government programs and policies in disfavor with Paul and with the crowd. The Patriot Act, for one thing, generated rounds of on-cue booing. Enough is enough, he said, about the loss of civil liberties, drawing another prolonged standing ovation.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
this is very good.
Yeah.
I mean, he, in this
the good
regard...
things are very good.
Yeah. Ron Paul, on civil liberties, particularly, is the best candidate of every one of them, including Barack Obama. Throughout the afternoon, Paul emphasized federal government has grown too large to work. That's not true. The principles of the nation's founders have been ignored or trampled. Partially true, partially not. Personal freedoms are under siege. That's true. Federal economic and monetary policies and foreign wars are ruinous. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mostly Reaganomics. The remedies lie in citizen involvement. Indeed. Those in charge are afraid of the Internet. Well, okay. He characterized the war on drugs as the most dangerous, as more dangerous and costly than drugs themselves.
Right.
Absolutely true.
Yeah, within there.
And Paul described the terrorist attacks of September 11th as having been used by government, quote, to do the things they wanted to do all along, a reference to the war launched by the Bush administration against Iraq. You're thinking, wait a minute, maybe we should be voting for this
but
guy.
But then...
The Taliban just want to be left alone, he said, of the Islamic fundamentalists fighting the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, and on and on. So, I mean, that all sounds good. His economic policies would be absolutely 100% disastrous. His, the idea of leaving things to the tender mercies of the state, like abortion and what have you, you just don't want to do. I mean, why, for instance, would he support, a Patriot Act in Michigan or something like that? I mean, why would the states have the rights to do that?
Right.
I want to talk about class war in just a little while, but I want to get some of you on the air that have been waiting a long time. Here's Sagan and Novi. Sagan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Okay, I was wanting to talk about this state of election Sure. It came up when my grandmother, whom I love very much, was talking to her brother, and he says, well, I'm going to vote for Ron Paul, and she told him, you're wasting your vote. Now, like I said, I love my grandma, but I had to lay a bit of a smack down here, and I said, no, Graham, you're wasting your vote if you vote for a president who you think is going to win. This isn't a horse race. You vote for the president, or you vote for, sorry, the candidate whom you think would make the best president. You don't vote for the one you think is going to have the best chance. And I have heard so many people say, oh, I'm not going to vote for Ron Paul because he doesn't have a chance. I was like, you know, if all of you people who said that actually voted for him, he would have a chance.
Well, that's probably true.
It infuriates me. Well, he would have better.
But, you know, Sagan, even more important than people voting their conscience rather than voting strategically is the amount of money. And Romney himself is big money, and he represents big money, and all his pals have big money. So he's able, like in some states,
well, Koch brothers.
Yeah, like having 10 to 1, you know, over, in terms of expenditure. So that, you know, that's a real factor.
Oh, yeah, I know money makes a big factor, but if you agree with a candidate's ideals, but you're not going to vote for him just because you don't think that
they're going to win. Well, what about the idea? I don't know. I think you were on hold when I was talking to Richard from the Green Party. And I said, well, some people would argue that if you vote for the Green Party, you're actually helping the Republican candidate because it would take votes across away from the Democrats. And he said it's, you know, better to vote your conscience. But
you know, I agree with that. But in the big picture, I just would much rather, because I know they're not going to win. I'd much rather have Barack Obama in there than Rick Santorum, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, any damn one of them.
Yeah, that is true.
That's where I stand and where I will stand. Although, hey, I identify with so much of the Green Party, so does Peter.
Yeah. And half of what Ron Paul says.
And half of Ron Paul. That's about it.
All right, Sagan, thank you very much. Thanks
for calling.
313-298-WRIF. Let's see. The mics, hold on just a minute. And let me. I want to get to one other thing. In fact, we're going to have a little musical interlude as well.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of musical interludes, I should get this on. Ron Paul Rick in East Point says, not sure if you guys can criticize Kid Rock on the air or not. Hey, I wonder how much Romney paid him. Maybe his dad put him up to it. Who's dad?
Ron Paul.
Ron Paul's dad, Romney's dad, or Kid Rock's dad? I don't know. But
I'm sure he meant Mitt Romney.
But you know that Kid Rock, you know, he's supposed to be so radical,
he
badass.
And he, Romney fan.
Yeah, and Ted Nugent endorsed Romney.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would have thought he would have gone for more crazoid.
Well, maybe he's taming down. I doubt it.
Rick asks, what motivates Kid Rock to stump for the Republican candidate with the most money? Maybe because Kid Rock's got the most money of most rockers.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? He's a millionaire like...
People forget where they come from.
Yeah, right. But you know, but that's not true. I mean, the Republican rockers, anybody creative that is a Republican is really the minority. Creative people, no matter how much money they
truly
make, overwhelmingly tend to are towards liberals and the left. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was I going to do, too? I forgot. Oh, yeah.
Music.
Yeah.
Music. You know, and before we go any further, I really want to thank some of our listeners came out to the show.
Oh, yeah. The David Rovick show.
At AJ's, which we've talked about earlier for tomorrow night. Jill Stein going to be there. Anyhow, it was a great turnout. Appreciate it. Had a great time.
And you sang.
And I sang. And there is a video of it. I think I put the video on our Facebook page.
On ours?
Yeah.
I didn't see it.
Okay. Well, also, if you just YouTube David Rovick's with Julian Jordan, there we are.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Okay. We're on YouTube. And it's called The Biggest Windmill. It's a great song.
Yeah. In the Netherlands. Or in the Netherlands? Or
in
Denmark.
Denmark, yeah.
Denmark, yeah. Well, so what did... Oh, yeah. So the Detroit News, when Occupy Detroit started, the Detroit News looked like the newsletter of Occupy Detroit. They gave it the most positive presentation representing reality. They would actually announce events. I remember my wife and I don't know why I picked up Detroit News and I said, hey, there's an event right here in our town. I didn't realize.
Amazing.
You know, so, but there is this creature from the Black Lagoon or something like that that runs the editorial page named Nolan Finley. And this guy is not known to have smiled in the last 35 years.
Yeah, I saw him on a local show, and his look completely matched his mentality.
Yeah, but he writes, he denounces Occupy Detroit. In fact, when that was coming about, I wrote him an email. He denounced it. So I wrote him an email message saying thanks, you know, for running, because any publicity is good
publicity.
Now he has another one out where he's attacking the United Auto Workers president, Bob King, who is, he says, will provide the ground troops for the president's class war.
Now,
this is so far from reality, one really doesn't know whether to defend or deny. That there's nothing even slightly about class warfare. There is class warfare going on, and you know who's losing? The 99%. Nolan Finley is the 1%, and he represents the 1%, for sure. And they keep going on about how this right-wing blog found evidence that King and the UAW are behind the 99% spring. Well, they're not really...
Explain what that is, Peter.
Okay, I will. And it's not really... where is my website? Yeah, you can go to Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And, I got so much other stuff in there. You got to go down a bit. Or to our Facebook page, mm-hmm. facebook.com/nightcall. And look for this banner that says the 99% spring. And a number of organizations and labor unions, including the UAW. So they're not, you know, if they were running it, I think this would be great. But they're not running it. They're just a constituent part of it. And they're planning in next month, mid-April, the 9th through the 15th, of training 100,000 Americans for nonviolent direct action against the banksters, against the corporations that have brought about this insecurity and misery, home foreclosures, and what have you. And one of the targets here in Detroit is going to be this meeting, I think maybe a stockholders meeting of General Electric. You know, these people that make billions
and pay no taxes.
Pay no taxes, right. So I'm trying to say, he says the UAW is behind, we know all the people, including Bob King, the president.
We know him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, is there a photograph on our Facebook of you
yes.
and me and, uh-huh. and Bob King?
Yes.
Yeah. Up in Lansing. It says the UAW behind the 99% spring, which aims to train and deploy 100,000 Americans for, quote, nonviolent direct action. Well, Bob King, speaking, we were talking earlier of religion, is motivated by what they call social witness. He's a Catholic activist.
Yeah.
But he doesn't try to shove it down anybody's throat. Remember that thing? I can say that again. Is
which
that
thing?
Religion is a penis?
What?
Like a penis?
Yeah?
Yeah. It's all right to have one. It's even all right to be proud of it, but don't try to shove it down people's throat.
Okay. Oh, my.
It says, files on the group's website indicate that the UAW is providing the organizational support for protests designed to support the president's narrative that America is divided into two camps, the wealthy 1% and the struggling 99%. Actually, that's not the president's narrative in the slightest.
No.
So it goes on and on. Let me see. It plays well into Bob King's style. He's a community activist at heart. It's true. And loves nothing better than toting a sign and shouting through a megaphone.
Yeah, he's out there.
Yeah. He's promised boycotts and marches to aid organizing drives of foreign automakers and UAW locals are forming units to train members and volunteers for political activism. Thank you, Nolan Finley. This is so wonderful of this.
Thanks for sharing what's going on in the 99%.
The country is clearly discontented, says Nolan Finley. He's recognized
clearly
that.
Discontented.
Yeah, because, the 1% who he represents and he himself, they're thinking that the people may be starting to assemble in the public square with pitchforks
scared.
Except Bob King is not going to show up with a pitchfork or a...
He's going to show up with a sign and a megaphone.
That's right. Obama's campaign should report the UAW's... as an in-kind contribution, blah, blah, blah. The union's hardworking members should know how much of their dues money is being spent on King's street gangs. Now, I just thought of that. Well, it's just...
Street literal. Gangs.
You know, there was somebody else that called for nonviolent direct action that also had a last name, King.
Oh, yeah. Martin Luther.
Oh, yeah. King. All right. Anyway, so the whole idea, and by the way, we do not want to separate Americas into 1% and 99%. We're all just one big people. Right,
right? One big happy family.
I've read this any number of times. This goes back, middle December. The six Waltons, the children, the people that never did a damn bit of work, the Walton family, who were the original owners of Walmart, the six Walton heirs, just who got the money, have more wealth than the bottom one-third of us.
Yes, they do.
Six people. Yep. All right. So
busy collecting art.
Eat the rich. Our friend, David Rovics, where is this baby? How come I can't find anything here? Maybe it's over here.
You've got it
Peter. It up. Introduce it for
Our
me.
Our friend David Rovics wrote a song about, addresses all of these criticisms of Obama. Although we're not big Obama sympathizers by any means, this is along the lines of everyone who says, he's a socialist and a Muslim and all of these different things. So this is called If Only It Were True.
And this is dedicated to the Detroit News' Nolan
Finley. It's for you, baby.
Nolan.
I turned on my TV, though it was hard to see these men who would be head of state. What a great country, from sea to shining sea, we watched the Republicans debate. Newt stood with his third wife and said, you bet your life, the president is a red. He wants to tax the rich a lot, take your limo and your yacht, he wants to have the bankers' heads. But if he gets in again, he'll paint the White House pink and then he'll hire Chavez as his VP. Then we'll be right on track to give capitalism the sack, along with the insurance industry. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. He'll give everyone food stamps and wheelchair ramps. He'll subsidize windmills and maple syrup. He'll cripple industries with eco-friendly policies. And pretty soon we will be just like Europe. He'll shut down oil wells and deliver solar cells to each home in Delaware and Illinois. He'll ban logging in the parks. He'll send the works of Karl Marx to the homes of every American girl and boy. He'll abolish pesticides. He'll be giving out free rides and free lunches, too, in his high-speed trains. He'll start lots of public works full of union perks. He'll fill all the cities up with bicycle lanes. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. Watch out, his critics tell, this shall be our death knell. He'll pull the troops out and end all of our wars. He'll gut military spending, our empire will be ending, and soon we'll be invaded by the Moors. He'll legalize all drugs, give away beer mugs and hookahs to every child and Korans. He'll ban religions from the schools, give 40 acres and a mule to every person who makes less than 50 grand. He'll shut down Guantanamo, to torture he'll say no. He'll make us all drive electric cars. He'll reinstate the fairness doctrine, take off that damn flag pin, and he'll put Rupert Murdoch behind bars. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true.
That's David Rovics on the Night Call Show on WRIF. You can David Rovics, that's R-O-V-I-C-S. You can just Google his name or go to davidrovics.com.
All of his music is available for free download.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to our phones. What do you think? Would that make you happy? Make me happy.
Me
Here's
too.
Mike in Fenton. Hey, Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Boy, you guys are fascinating. If only it were true.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, a couple things. I wanted to speak on that over there with Israel and that, and then the presidential race.
Sure. What's up?
I think over there with the Israel thing, they've already made up their mind. I think the Republicans were going to attack Afghanistan and Iraq, and they had planned on going into Iran, but they didn't expect Obama to get in, so they had a four-year wait on that. So I think that was just part of their plan. And so they've already made up their mind to attack that, and so they're going to attack Iran. It seems to be pretty obvious. Talking about it out in the
open. Well, don't you think everything might go to kind of hell, that they might figure, well, you know, paybacks are MFs, you know, and if we bomb their cities, maybe they'll bomb our cities.
I don't think they really care, because they're going to be all right, and they got places to go, and they don't really have to worry about it. So that's not really that big of a concern to them like it would be to us. But as far as the election goes, if anybody couldn't see at this point that the Democrats don't run things and the Republicans aren't running things, and somebody else's or there's else's running things behind the scenes, and they're not looking after our best interests. So it's not going to do us any good to get a Mitt Romney or a Obama in there. They're not really running things, so they're not responsible for this. There's some other people responsible. And as far as Mitt Romney goes, I was wondering, what is his name? I'm not going to vote for a guy that calls himself Mitt, and I don't even know what his first name is.
That's funny. We talk about that all the time.
Willard. Yeah.
It's Willard.
Willard.
Willard. Yeah, Willard the Rat.
Yeah, there was a movie called Willard. It was about Rat. Well, you know, one of the things that we tend to do is to put all of our eggs in the electoral basket. In other words, beginning of two sentences, we think, you know, We hope that Barack Obama will, you know, solve all our problems. Now, you know, there's people that are thinking, gee, I hope Romney will solve all our problems. Or people are hoping Ron Paul will, or the Green Party, or something like that. Well, there's a lot of activity that has occurred throughout American history that changed American history that culminated, perhaps, in the electoral arena or in the, you know, congressional arena. But it always came about through mass movements. And that's what's missing here. I mean, there's nobody to hold any of these candidates' feet to the fire. So they'll say anything. The only thing I like that Romney ever said was he didn't want to set his hair on fire to get attention, the way, you know, because the most extraordinary things come out of the mouths of these other candidates. All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it very much. Another big old primary coming up in Ohio. Here's Steve from Toledo. Steve, what's up?
Hey, an old friend of mine was telling me, oh, by the way, first-time caller, long-time listener.
Well, welcome, Steve.
Hey, welcome.
Well, somebody was telling me a while back, Mitt Romney's father used to be part of Michigan, and...
Well, wait. He was the governor of Michigan, and he was also president of American Motors, the car company that made, what do they make, Rambler and Ashes, and whatever the hell did they make? I can't remember. But a bunch of other cars.
Didn't he send the troops in when they had the big riots of Detroit?
That's interesting. It was 1967. Yeah, you know, it must have been him, because then he ran for president, George Romney, the father, did in 1968. So, yeah, it could have been him, sent in the guard.
Yeah.
And then,
he was telling me that he seems like, you know, Mitt Romney, everybody's starting to like him, but he also, he was telling me he's the type of guy that would, he's a flipper.
He's a flipper and a flopper.
Yeah.
Yep. He's like a fish out of water.
Yeah.
And his grandmother was a flapper.
And his dad wanted to be polyamorous or polygamous.
No. His grandfather was polygamous
and moved to Mexico,
where George Romney, Mitt's father, was born. Yeah.
And yeah.
So does that? People wondered. I guess we talked about that when people said that, you know, like if I would have, my parents would have been in England and I would have been born there, I'd still be an American citizen.
Right.
Yeah. That he did order it in. But it was, you know, also was a Democratic president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who sent in the 101st Airborne into Detroit as well. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. You know, I'm sort of running out of stories here. Tell him the phone number. I got to find another story. I want everything to talk about.
Stop it. Go ahead. Stop with that noise, Peter.
Wait a minute.
Oh, please.
Oh, wait, here's one.
Oh.
Here's one way in the back of the paper.
I'm glad you found it.
Yeah. Saudi Arabia may be tied to 9/11. That's just hiding in the back.
Wait, maybe being that all of them except for two, from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. For more than a decade, questions have lingered about the possible role of the Saudi government in the attacks on September 11, 2001, even as the Royal Kingdom has made itself a crucial counterterrorism partner in the eyes of American diplomats. Now, in sworn statement that seemed to reignite the debate, two former senators who were privy to top-secret information on the Saudis' activities say they believe that the Saudi government might have played a direct role in the terrorist attack. And this is hidden in, like, page 17 of the New York Times on February 29th. And I'm not sure whether I saw the nightly news. Anybody else see any of this on the news? Former Senator Bob Graham, Democrat of Florida, I'm convinced there was a direct line between at least some of the terrorists who carried out the September 11th attacks and the government of Saudi Arabia. Bob Kerry of Nebraska, a Democrat who served on the separate 9/11 commission, said in a sworn affidavit significant questions remain unanswered about the role of Saudi institutions.
They're our buddies.
How did they get, I was looking at more of this up online, and I was wondering, how did they get all the photographs of the guys that did it?
I always wondered that, too.
In fact, they said they found, the ID of one of them.
Where?
In the wreckage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, everything gets incinerated so hot, allegedly.
Yeah, the pictures looked kind of the same.
That it melts.
Remember that?
What is it, some racist thing?
No, I mean the shot, the background. They all looked like they were taken in the same room.
Oh,
Peter,
no.
How dare you?
All right. Let's continue onward. Here's Fred. Fred, hi, you're on the air. Where are you calling from? Did I do this wrong? No.
Hello?
Hey, Fred, where are you calling from? Fred, you're on the air.
From Detroit.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. I was listening to the conversation a few minutes ago about the Green Party and the Libertarians, and I've told you before that I'm not exactly thrilled by the Democrats and Obama. I feel like the so-called Blue Dog Democrats really are Republicans in liberal clothing or semi-liberal clothing.
Yeah.
But I kind of think, and it's been tossed about lately, that, presidents, just like any congressman, can really only do so much. And this really happens with the Democrats. It's like they're sort of like prisoners to whatever's going on. If you look at, for instance, you mentioned LBJ.
Sure.
Remember, he had huge plans. It was called the Great Society.
Well, he did get a lot
of the legislation
passed.
He stumbled into Vietnam,
right,
not wanting to be the first American president to lose a war.
Right. Fred, that was Nixon who said that. I will not be the first American president to preside over a losing war. And he did.
But I think Lyndon originally had that. He got in over his head and it wrecked his presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come forward to Clinton. He had to try to make up for all of his faults in his last, two or three years in office. And now you got Obama. I don't think he's as liberal as everybody had hoped, but with a better Congress behind him, I think he could have been nudged. Because, for instance, you look at this super PAC business. I don't think he would need to take that money if it wasn't for all the money on the right.
Well, yeah, and that goes back, of course, I'm sure you know, to that Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, that said that money was speech and that you couldn't, prohibit these large donations. So you get a guy like this Sheldon Adelson from the casino's giving $10 million at a crack to a crackpot like Newt Gingrich. So,
well, exactly.
Yeah, so the politics are toxic. What do you think, Fred, that if we got money completely out of politics and it just allowed people to make themselves known on the basis of what they stood for and what kind of changes they advocated? If you've listened to the show, I mean, you call every once in a while, so you may be listening, that I said that a contest properly should be between somebody like Dennis Kucinich on the left and Ron Paul on the right, and there's great amount of agreement, particularly on things like civil liberties, the drug war, foreign intervention, the United States Empire, and what have you. The American people, in the main, agree with those two men. And the fact that these other politicians are able to swirl about the electoral process because of hundreds of millions of dollars just means we live in a corrupt system, under a corrupt system.
Well, I agree with that. If you take the money out, the people on the right would have much less to offer in the way of coherent policy.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that I feel like the Democrats, whoever they have in leadership, always seems to get swept along, you know, by the Israel lobby and whatever other lobby.
Yes, and then people have the nerve to say that Obama is trying to make up for 3 years of not doing anything for Israel.
Yeah, and just the big money to begin with. And it, I mean, you know, every institution has this built-in inertia. So we have this imperial system that feeds or creates the necessity for this military-industrial complex. And to cut it out, to see that this is the, one of the things that's destroying our economy, is just too tough to do for any politician given current circumstances. And that's what I'm talking about. That would take a mass movement to put wind in the sails of any politician. And you can see how it resonates. The only, think about this, of all the liberals and all the conservatives, the only politician that is really giving voice to this anti-imperial, pro-civil liberties, you know, all of that stuff, anti-drug war stuff, is Ron Paul. And when he shows up, at Michigan State, he's got almost 4,000 young people waiting for him. That says something. All right, Fred, I got to do some business. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. You know, you've heard the phrase, "She stole my heart."
Yeah.
I got a story next about when it's not a saying.
Oh, my.
Ooh. You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
For listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our final segment, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743. If you want to get in, you've got about 20 or so minutes to do so.
And at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, Brian Miller will be my guest. He's, you know, this is what a boring title. I didn't want to tell this guy. The Self-Made Myth and the Truth About How Government Helps Businesses and Individuals Succeed. But it's an interesting interview because what it's really looking at is the myth that they're these self-made men, you know, that you know, Sam Walton and the Waltons who own, the six Walton heirs who own more than 30% of the American population, more wealth and
so
all
that.
So
you're saying it's old money being passed along? More
yeah, and that these people didn't do it by themselves, that there's this whole you know, support structure, everything from schools to roads. I mean, they couldn't have done it without all of us. I mean, but in any event, it's...
Without the 99%.
I hope Brian's not listening. I mean, and the book is interesting. The interview is very interesting. But I was just getting on the title. My website's Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. All right. You've heard the phrase, you know, she stole my heart away and all that. And the heart, you know, with the basis of the emotions. It's really the brain, but... Or with men, well, never mind.
Yeah, I know where you're going.
Yeah. Anyway, this is from Dublin. Somewhere in Ireland, a burglar has the heart of a saint. Officials at Christ Church Cathedral in Dublin said Sunday they're distraught and perplexed over the theft of the church's most precious relic, the preserved heart of St. Lawrence O'Toole, patron saint of Dublin. This is not The Onion, folks. Relics in the Catholic Church, pieces of these saints are all over.
Like pieces of their bodies.
Yeah, O'Toole's heart has been displayed in the cathedral since the 13th century. It was stored in a heart-shaped wooden box and secured in a small square iron cage in the wall of a chapel dedicated to his memory. On Saturday, someone cut through two bars, pried the cage loose, and made off with the relic. I mean, you get... Weird. It's mighty.
The whole thing's weird.
Yeah, the whole thing's weird. It's weird that they have it, and it's even more weird that someone wanted to steal it. The Most Reverend Dermot Dunn said, "I'm devastated that one of the treasured artifacts of the cathedral is stolen. It's a priceless treasure. It has no economic value." Ireland's National Police said detectives were studying hours of closed-circuit TV footage to try to identify the approximately 40 people who walked out of the cathedral. Maybe with their heart, you heard your heart in your throat with a heart in his hand, right?
Yeah.
But it gets worse. You know, I saw this.
Now,
one.
This was so, you sent this to me, and I thought it was a joke at first.
The thing about the heart?
No, the other thing.
The other thing. Now, this is
bizarre.
Defies, yeah, the holy foreskin.
The holy foreskin.
Yeah. This is in Judaism, of which I know a lot of Christians don't like to hear this, but Jesus was a Jew, and and like Muslims, they and some other lot of other primitive people in the world, that doesn't sound right. Primitive
no, that people, sounded
yeah,
really bad.
Yeah, but well, primitive people, a number of primitive people have circumcision. That's what we're talking about, circumcision. And then there is the holy foreskin. Well, Jesus, according to the story, went to heaven, but the foreskin stayed.
God.
Right? But it's also true in the Jewish religion that you have to go out of the world just like you came in. So there can't be like body mutilation or tattoos or stuff like that. So I don't know what this says about it. But in any event, the holy foreskin is one of the several relics attributed to Jesus, a product of the circumcision of him. At various points in history, a number of churches in Europe have claimed to possess Jesus' foreskin, sometimes at the same time. Various miraculous powers have been ascribed to it. All Jewish boys are required by Jewish religious law to be circumcised on the eighth day following their birth.
It's called a bris or something.
The Feast of the Circumcision of Christ. This
okay.
is real. Still celebrated by many churches around the world, accordingly falls on January 1st. And according to Luke 2:21, and when 8 days were accomplished for circumcising of the child, his name was called Jesus, which was so named of the angel before he was conceived in the womb. The first reference to the survival of Christ's severed foreskin, boy, that makes me just twitch, comes in the second chapter of the apocryphal Arabic infancy gospel, which contains the following story. Oh, yeah, the Apocrypha, which are these books of the Bible that, when was it, like the Council of Nicaea or something like that in like 375 A.D.?
Yeah.
These priests got together and they said, well, this story's too weird. We're not putting this in the Bible. They were so they said, yeah, Luke goes in, the one where Jesus had a third eye and would kill people with it. They're not putting that. I mean, that's real. I'm not making any of this up. Let's see. So here's what's in the Arabic infancy gospel. And when the time of his circumcision was come, namely the eighth day on which the law commanded the child to be circumcised, they circumcised him in a cave. And the old Hebrew women took the foreskin and preserved it in an alabaster box of oil, of old oil of spikenard. Spikenard.
What? This just makes me feel nauseous.
Yeah. Now, there's a few more. And now this is that alabaster box which Mary the sinner procured and poured forth the ointment out of it upon the head and feet of our Lord Jesus Christ and wiped it off with it.
Yeah.
So this is pretty weird. But you know,
Where is the foreskin, allegedly?
This was out of Wikipedia. If you don't believe any of this, just Google Holy Foreskin. And, I mean, this is very, you know, they make fun of the Mormons because they've got all this, you know, like magic underwear. I mean, this is real, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, actually, you tell me. I think this is okay. I mean, listen, Drew and Mike broadcast on this station in the morning.
You need to clear this through.
I can't do it. But, you know, there's this Jewish ritual circumcision, right?
Yeah.
And
it's
so,
not just Jewish, though.
No, but then, so there's a story that one of the guys that did it, the priest or whatever who does it, saved all these foreskins, and he made this little change purse out of it, right?
Oh, God.
Yeah. But then when you kissed it, it became a suitcase.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God. How do you do this to me?
Do I have a job still?
Yes, you do. That was fine.
Yeah, okay. All right. Let's go back to our
313-298-WRF.
Here's Ed and Taylor. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hey, Ed.
What's up?
I was calling about, you know these cameras they use for surveillance?
Yeah.
Like in Europe and that?
Yeah, they're everywhere in Europe, particularly England.
But I didn't think they were going to do it here, but now I get Toledo News here. And, you know, they're starting, okay, they had the traffic cameras. They had about 11. They're getting 11 more of those.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to have, they got a command center that they're making, and they're going to have like four officers in there, and they're going to have 150 cameras up by May all over Toledo, and they're going to have roaming trucks that they park outside of sporting events with cameras on them, and this is like the first phase or something like that, you know. So I mean, you're going to have cameras all over and watching the streets and everything. Well, I didn't think that there's,
you know, that's interesting, because on one hand, you know, there's always this thing of, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong, why do you object to it?
Yeah, I'm still not a fan.
There's something weird about being surveilled all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, they may wind up suffering from sort of input overload. I mean, if we're all under surveillance all the time, I mean, that's what happened.
And that sounds like an awful lot of surveillance.
Yeah, after 9/11, that the National Security Council and other agencies like that received so much information that they couldn't even process it. You know what I mean?
My sister got caught by one of those traffic cameras, and I got to tell you, it was the funniest video I've seen in a really long time of her blowing through a red light.
Really?
Because they send you the video.
Yeah? And with a ticket?
Yeah, they sent it. Actually, I don't know, but my dad was a car dealer for a very long time. They sent the ticket to my dad along with the email. And, you know, we're adults, so my dad watches it. I swear he was so thrilled by it. He said, thank you for the laugh. I'll just pay the ticket.
Everybody,
watch out for
10 minutes of fame. So what do you think? What is it, just creepy or what? Is it, going authoritarian society? What's the objection, Ed?
It's It's supposed to be for crime prevention, right. You know, but I just think it's weird. It's going to be like, you know, it's going to be like everybody, you're going to have cameras on you everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't think they were going to do it in this country. Now, I guess it costs so many million dollars, I don't think they have the money or whatever in Detroit right now, but if they're doing it in Toledo, it's probably going to come to Michigan next, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you think about some of these cities that with budget shortfalls and well, maybe they'll do that. They'll, you know, they'll get rid of all the live police officers.
Yeah,
and
just watch us on video.
Watch it all. They won't do anything. They'll go, hey, look, somebody's breaking into our house.
Be like reality TV.
And they can, well, you know, they'll get all these metrics. They'll this is in the future. They won't even have to, like, send a car out there because there won't be any, you know, officers to staff the car. They'll just be able to hone in on the perpetrator, get all these metrics like from his eye, because we'll all have to do, you know, iris scans when we're born and all that.
And they could have someone like on every block who's the, you know, in charge of the block. They go just arrest him right there.
There you go. All right, and thank you very much. Yeah, something to look out for. Remember, what was that woman? Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
She's moving into the Monica Lewinsky category of
that's the best
big,
news.
Yeah, but she's actually going to be back with a roar, although she's not very pleased about it.
Oh, this is there's an HBO documentary.
Yeah, well, there's this best-selling book called Game Change about Sarah Palin being chosen by John McCain to be vice presidential candidate 4 years ago. So there's an HBO movie that's starting on Thursday, I think, on the 10th. Is that the...
No, it's Saturday because my birthday is Friday the 9th.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So Saturday, why would they be... Anyway, premieres on March 10th, based on the book by the same name, and it portrays Palin in a largely negative light during the 2008 campaign, suggesting that she knew little about policy and became difficult to deal with as the campaign wore on. And
so she's
pissed off, you know. That's not true. I knew a lot about. Remember all those gaffes that woman made? It was so
pathetic. Awful. It was good entertainment. Do you think she thinks at all? You know, we all are human. We know we have faults. We know we make mistakes, right, Peter? You admit when you were
me?
No. You know, she honestly, I think she thinks that nothing she does is wrong, or she never makes any mistakes, or.
Well, it's you know, in many ways that this was the ascendancy of the far kooky right when she became.
Yeah, she started it.
Here's John McCain, who would be drummed out of the Republican Party today if he tried to run for president, as being a liberal. Right?
Oh,
compared
for sure.
to the rest of these guys, even by Romney. All right, let's grab a couple calls because time. We got some open lines and some time left for you. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Jack in Detroit. Jack, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I'm Julian.
Hello.
Hi, Jack. Was that funny? Okay. I like that.
You are amusing yourself.
Yeah. Well, it's Eric from Southgate.
What's up, Eric?
I want to say that I live on $7,000 a year and have for the last 20 years.
How do you do that? That's hard for most people. Because you know what? Let me just tell you this. They consider so you're like about $5,000 or $6,000 below the official poverty line.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it?
I have a strong family.
Good.
And it's the riff, rock, and roll family, baby.
Oh, baby, yeah.
So, I mean, right. What do you mean? Your family helps you out?
Exactly. My sisters and my brothers, although I have no brothers. But I think Ed is my son.
Remember this guy?
Yeah.
Grow some weed. Yeah, that's how you do it.
Okay, there you go.
There you go. All right.
Okay.
You know, did you hear? He didn't even say, this is Jack from Detroit, but he said he was Ed from Southgate.
I know.
Yeah. Here's UC. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on, man?
You're okay. Were you on the air before?
Yeah, I called and then they hung up and then I called back.
No.
Well, we kind of have a little thing that we try to adhere to here on Night Call, and that's one phone call per show, but you're welcome to call back next week.
Yeah, please do. Please do that. All right. We just got a few minutes left, so I don't know if there are any loose ends really to...
And you know there always are, Peter. How about the woman, the lesbian woman who was denied communion at her mother's funeral? Here, do you want mine? You
have it? I got it. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Since, this was so appalling.
Yeah.
Came out Thursday.
As her elderly mother was dying, Barbara Johnson lay next to her on the hospital bed, reciting Hail Mary. Loetta Johnson, 85, had been a devout Catholic, raising her four children in the church and sending them to Catholic schools. Probably knowing nothing about the Holy Foreskin, right? We mentioned earlier. At her mother's funeral mass at St. John Newman Catholic Church in Gaithersburg, Gaithersburg, Maryland, a grieving Barbara Johnson was the first in line to receive communion.
So she's at her mom's funeral. Okay.
Yeah. What happened next stunned her. The priest refused Johnson, who is gay, the sacramental bread and wine.
You said that too fast. Now, you're always accusing me of saying things too fast.
Go ahead.
Who it refused her because she is gay. Wouldn't give her communion.
Right. According to Johnson, he covered the bowl with the Eucharist with his hand and looked at me and said, I cannot give you communion because you live with a woman and that is a sin in the eyes of the church.
Ugh.
Her older brother, Larry Johnson, couldn't believe what he had seen. He told ABC News, I walked to the side of the church to console her because she was clearly distraught. Larry Johnson said his sister, who has been in a committed gay relationship for 19 years, composed herself enough to give her mother's eulogy, but then he was shocked at what happened next. The priest left the altar and didn't return until his sister was nearly finished speaking.
What a scumbag.
Well, that's one way to put it. Family members added the priest failed to come to the gravesite, and the burial was attended by a substitute priest found by the funeral director. And the family wants the priest to apologize.
Yeah.
The brother said, this isn't about gay rights. It isn't about Catholic bashing. It is simply about the conduct of a reprehensible priest.
Okay, reprehensible is a little bit better.
So, you know, you say, well, was this even any of my biz because I'm not a Catholic and I think they're kind of, you know, anyway.
We don't have time to cover the Catholic Church in its entirety tonight.
But here's what this all leads to. When you have that kind of, beyond just an opinion, you know, I mean, it's one thing to have a personal opinion that ends up in the discrimination or hurt towards a whole group of people. But when it has a religious underpinning, then it has a quality to it that seems to grab people at an even deeper level. Because there's lots of people who, even though they may say they believe in God or they believe, say they're Christian or whatever other religion, if you say to them, what do you think about gay marriage or gay couples? Mm-hmm. You know, by now people say, I don't like it, but I don't care. You know, it's up to them.
Yeah.
I mean, live and let live.
Right.
Right. Wouldn't that be nice? But what happens when it begins mixed with religion? That it begins things like this. Remember that in Uganda, in Africa, that there was this bill introduced in 2009 that carried the death penalty for a serial offender of, quote, the offense of homosexuality.
Yeah.
And so where do they get this idea? Where did these, there's a lot of societies in which homosexuality is punished. But you know what?
Yeah.
It never stops gay people because the sexual drive is so deep and so ingrained that you need, I mean.
It's who they are, you know?
Because never mind. This will disconfuse them.
Okay.
You're threatened with death. And yet, your nature, your core nature, your internal definition of your sexuality, says, I want to love and I want to have sex with somebody of the same gender, and you still go ahead with it. Where does this all come from? Well, get this. Much of Africa's anti-homosexuality movement is supported by American evangelicals.
Of course.
These right-wing Christians who aren't content enough to make their own lives miserable, they have to spread it to other people. Reverend Kapia Kaoma of Zambia wrote in 2009, the evangelicals who are keen to export the American culture war to new ground. Indeed, American evangelical Christians played a role in stirring the anti-homosexual sentiment that culminated in that legislation in Uganda.
Yeah. If it's not enough that they do it here, and then also there's something going on in Russia.
Yeah, but wait a minute. There's one more part to it that is really important. and that is that in the United States, as one politician contended, he first became close with a group of influential social conservatives, including politicians, known as the Fellowship. If you don't have anything to do, Google the Fellowship. In fact, there is a there's a book by I can't remember.
Or write it down and Google it later.
Yeah, who it is. But anyway, it was in the United States that this politician first became close with a group of influential social conservatives known as the Fellowship, which would be later become a base of inspiration and technical support for the anti-homosexual bill. He said the idea for the bill first sprang from a conversation with members of the Fellowship in 2008 because it was, quote, too late in America to propose such legislation. And that means that state after state is okaying gay marriage.
Yeah, Maryland just did.
Oh, yeah, it did. And the Fellowship, Google that. And it's a U.S.-based religious and political organization, and it is filled. It's a secret organization.
Yeah.
It's filled with these. Here's who I was looking for, although I lost it again in here. The author who has written a whole book about it. But they're really, this is like Opus Dei or, you know, the secret Catholic organization.
Yeah.
And, Jeff Charlotte, Charlet. He wrote a book called The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism of the Heart of American Power. And all these right-wing politicians are deeply involved in this. It throws, you know, remember, maybe anybody who was listening for a couple hours, remember I was quoting Newt Gingrich at the beginning of the show that said, the lookout for the secular left, that they want to alter America. Well, the secular left has been the driving force, first, as I said earlier, behind the American Revolution itself, for ending slavery.
Yeah, for a lot of really good things.
Yeah, all of this stuff. This is what the secular left is about. This is what these people that are violating the American Constitution, its prohibition against the insertion of religion into the body politic, because it poisons. People say it poisons both religion and politics, but no, it poisons politics. Mm-hmm. One nation under God, Iran.
Right. Let's leave you it want there. That?
Hey, dear friends, thank you for listening, and thank you for calling, Sarah and Athena. Thank you so much. They will have a podcast ready in about 11 hours, and
yes,
you can go to our Facebook page and get the announcement when it's there, or WRF.com will do it as well.
Yeah.
It is Facebook.com/Night Call, and stay tuned.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call. Right after this, we're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. A little very quick story. First off, the first day of Occupy Detroit in October, there was a demonstration down there, and I went down with a friend of mine to video it, and I was going to do the interviewing, right? That's kind of what I do. And there was a very young woman, 17, 18 years old, with a sign that said, "Eat the rich." So I said, okay, this will make a good visual, and I'll see what she has to say. What are her policy statements about the disproportionate wealth in this country and all that? So I said, what does your sign mean? And she looked at me steely-eyed and said, "Which word don't you understand?" I went, whoa. All right. Well, there's a lot of talk. I mean, having been brought up by the Occupy movement, and not that this is anything new, but it's leaped to the public consciousness. So things like the 1% and the 99% have entered the lexicon faster than teenage slang. And because this goes right to the title of the book we're going to talk about. One of the myths is that the wealthy are the people that create the jobs. They're the job creators. And that a lot of what people are criticizing about the way wealth is distributed in this society has to do with envy and resentment. And this is a country in which anyone can do anything financially. The poorest people become the wealthiest. And that's what makes this land so great. Well, is that true? And there is something called the Horatio Alger myth. That was from the 19th century, which saw these poor immigrants like Andrew Carnegie would come over and was a rag picker and, you know, becomes in modern terms, a billionaire. But let's take a look at what that is. There's a book that's just come my way. It's called The Self-Made Myth. It It's written by Brian Miller and Mike Lapham, and it's a foreword by Bill Gates Sr. That's Bill Gates Jr.'s dad, and Chuck Collins, who founded United for a Fair Economy. We're going to talk with Brian Miller. He's the co-author of this. He's the executive director of United for a Fair Economy, and he's been doing 20 that sounds like a sentence. He's had 20 years as a community organizer, coalition leader, media spokesperson, writer, and nonprofit director. Let's bring to our microphones from his office in Boston, Brian Miller. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Peter. Glad to be on.
Yeah, thank you very much. And this, your book, The Self-Made Myth, and I should say the subtitle, and the truth about how government helps individuals and businesses succeed. Well, that you, I don't hear that very much any longer, but that's what it was. It was the Horatio Alger myth that anybody can rise in the class structure. And that, that dominated, well, still does to some extent. That's why you've written the book, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, this book really grew out of the work of United for a Fair Economy and the work we've been doing with high wealth individuals and business leaders who through our Responsible Wealth Project. And this is an interesting breed of folks who recognize that their success is not entirely their own and that they have an obligation to pay back toward the society that made their success possible through progressive tax policies and so forth. And really, what this book really goes to is how we view the creation of wealth and individual success has profound impacts on the way we view inequality, taxes, the role of government, and more. And for that reason, it's important that we have an honest discussion about that success.
I think so. In your book, The Self-Made Myth, you talk about of the top 400 wealthiest people, maybe a third of them were born to wealth. But doesn't that leave two-thirds then that are self-made, mostly men?
Well, I think more specifically, a third of them were born on the Fortune 400 list.
Okay.
More than just being born to wealth. They were born on the Fortune 400 list. The other two-thirds were generally born to wealth as well. Perhaps not the the top 400, but they made their way there. So absolutely, you know, the reality is that one of the really important determinants in whether a person is successful or not is really the head starts they got in life. You know, were they born to a family of wealth? Were they born white? Were they born male? Did they have connections? I mean, a lot of these, you know, we tell the story of Ross Perot. And his story really had to do with connections that he had. He got a no-bid contract to design the Medicare system and rode it all the way up to extraordinary wealth. The software that drove the Medicare system, I should say, and rode that to wealth. That was about connections. That's about privilege. And that's a big part of determining who succeeds and who doesn't. And that's an important thing to recognize.
The book is A Self-Made Myth. My guest is the co-author, Brian Miller. And I think everyone has a story. Either they recognize a story outside of their own circle of someone who was born in the working class, sometimes poor, usually born in the working class, yet they say has become rich, which generally means the upper middle class, I mean, below $375,000. Or once in a while, you will find people that will say, hey, look, I was born in a bad part of town, broken family. I had to work three jobs while I went to night school, and now I'm a millionaire. I mean, I did it, me, my hard work.
Mm-hmm. And there is a narrative about that, and the reality is that there's a lot of factors that actually contribute to individual success. Part of it is those head starts in life I just talked about. Other factors are luck, historical timing. Yes, hard work is also important. But once you've got all that lined up, then whatever success you have is magnified many, many, many times over by all the taxpayer-supported investments that we pay for in education, healthcare, transportation infrastructures, courts and regulations that really magnify the business success of those who are at the top.
But wouldn't you think that most people would understand that? But there actually is an odd support for that sense that it's their money, you know, that they earned it, maybe I've never gotten to be more than just a $13 an hour worker, but someone else who, in a sense, I had the same opportunity, but even with all that, the public tax dollars that go in to support the rise in the class structure, at some level, that it's this American spirit of individual striving and creativity and economic sense of what to do.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there is, and there's a certain element of this myth, the self-made myth. And that is, of course, the notion that, that individual and business success is entirely the result of gumption and hard work and short-term sacrifice. Part of it is it just feels good to pat oneself on the back and say, I did it. You know, it just feels good. But the problem is, again, it's dishonest because there are a lot of other factors that, that helped one succeed. And more importantly, it's damaging to our political discourse. And while you don't hear the term self-made man heard a lot in today's dialogue, you do hear the echoes of it. You hear the echoes of it every time a tax proposal comes out and someone says, it's their money, they should be able to keep it. You know, mm-hmm. that is, or when there's a millionaire's tax proposed and some conservative pundit gets up and starts screaming, this is going to punish success. You know, all of these words, again, the assertion here is that it's their success and their success alone. They created that wealth by themselves. And that really is the self-made myth being echoed time and time again in our modern dialogue. And it distorts the way we view public policies, from the role of government to the role of taxes to inequality. And, you know, coming back to the inequality issue, and this is an important one, because one of the challenges we face, you know, Occupy's done a phenomenal job of raising the visibility of rising inequality in this nation. I can't remember a time in my organizing career where there's been so much awareness that the top 1%, the top 0.1% control such extraordinary wealth. We have a great opportunity before us, but as long as people can rationalize it away as the result of differing work effort, which is what the self-made mm-hmm. myth says, then our efforts to rein in inequality are going to fall flat. If we're going to really work to rein in extreme inequality in this nation, we need to go at the ideological underpinnings of that inequality. And that means taking on the self-made myth and pointing out that the success of those at the top is not entirely because they worked harder than everyone else, they're smarter than everyone else, or they made more sacrifices than everyone else. It's not. And that's an important thing to challenge.
The book is The Self-Made Myth and the Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed. It's published by Barrett Kohler Publishers, and that's bkconnection.com. There's also a website for the book, selfmademyth.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, peterwerby.com. Well, talk to me a little, though, about the argument that what we see is when people are criticizing wealth, that it's based on resentment, that class resentment, and you treated that partly because, you know, the idea, the myth is that anybody can do this. And when some have and some haven't, well, the haven'ts, they resent then what the haves have, if you will.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a flip side to this myth. There's a flip side to this myth, which is that if you believe that those at the top are wealthy and successful because they worked harder and they were smarter than everyone else, then you're likely to believe that those at the bottom are there because they don't work hard, because uh-huh. they're lazy, they're slothful. And then if they express any frustration about the current distribution of wealth, you just accuse them of being envious or resentful. And that's entirely not the case. The reality is there's a recognition that the current distribution of wealth and income is simply unjustified. We cannot justify the levels of inequality this nation has based on work, based on different work efforts.
How does it work in other countries? Because the tax structure in, say, any of the other industrial capitalist nations is, it's not, the inequality isn't quite like that. In fact, it's dramatically different in a lot of the Scandinavian countries. And the wealthy, I don't know. I mean, the wealthy don't seem to complain so loudly about their tax bite.
You know, it's hard. It's hard for me to speak about how the wealthy in other countries view themselves and relate to the broader politic in their communities. I can tell you what we've experienced with the responsible wealth members. And
remind people what responsible wealth is too.
Sure. Responsible Wealth, it's a project of United for a Fair Economy. And through Responsible Wealth, we bring together about 700 business leaders and high wealth individuals who really recognize that inequality is bad for everyone, including them. And these are business leaders who've spoken out in favor of limiting CEO salaries, who've spoken out in favor of a strong estate tax, in favor of ending the Bush tax cuts for top income earners. And part of the reason these business leaders have this differing view is a recognition that their business success and their wealth is only partially because of their hard work. You know, other factors contributed, luck, timing, and the taxpayer-supported investments. And I think the last one's really is worth a little bit of discussion because, you know, there's sort of two sets of factors, one of which is this luck and privilege that allows one to turn their hard work into a business success. But the second one is the investments in the common good, the taxpayer-supported roads and education system and other infrastructure, that once a business is successful, once a person is successful, their business success and their wealth is magnified many times over. And the business leaders we talk to, people like Kim Jordan of New Belgium Brewing, Thelma Kidd of Davis Kidd Booksellers in the book, they really recognize that their business would not be successful if it weren't for the publicly funded roads, if it weren't for the education system to supply them with workers to design their software or develop their ad campaigns, if it weren't for the court system to protect their copyrights and the regulations to provide a level playing field. And importantly, the higher you get on this economic ladder, the bigger your business is, the more of those public services you're using. And these business leaders recognize, because of that, it's only right and fair that they pay a higher percentage of their income back towards supporting those very structures that makes their success possible.
Right, Miller, you have any idea what the wealthy do with their money? I mean, once they've gotten every single bauble and car and island and what have you, if you have a wealth of $25 billion, you obviously can't consume up to that. I mean, I don't know what, I mean, someone ought to work on that. What's the maximum anybody could consume? I'm sure it would probably be maybe $100 million at the most or something like that. So where is their money, and what do they do anything with it, or does it just pop up on a list every year?
Well, I think, you know, there's been a big case made by a lot of folks that once you have so much wealth in so few people's hands, that you stop running out of usable things to do with it.
Sure.
And it fuels, and it's part of what fueled this heat up to the economic collapse is, you know, people started betting on, Wall Street basically turned into a casino, and people started betting on things that didn't even exist. You know, there were whole investments around derivatives, which means you're not buying anything. You're just buying the concept of whether the Dow goes up or down. And that's what happens when you have so much wealth in so few hands, and it sends the markets wildly fluctuating, and it's not productive. It's not productive for our economy. And, you know, one of the people we quote in the book, Garrett Gruner, he's the founder of Ask.com, makes a really compelling case that, you know, we need to stop thinking that more money in the hands of investors is going to help the economy, because as long as we have the kind of inequality that we have and there's not money in the hands of middle-class Americans, it doesn't matter how much money investors have. They're not going to invest it if there's no one to buy what they produce.
Yeah, that goes back to that whole supply side. That is, in other words, the more that the so-called job creators have to invest, the more jobs they will tend to create, as opposed to demand side, which means the more money we have, the more we'll spend, and then, you know, hence that will create more jobs. I don't know why that seems so self-evident, particularly what's happened over the last few years. I don't know why it hasn't sunk in to these guys. The book is The Self-Made Myth and the Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed. There's a website for it, which is the selfmademyth.org. There's no, am I saying it right? There's not the in there, right? It's just selfmademyth.org. And my guest is Brian Miller. He's the co-author of it with Mike Latham. Actually, I've said his name differently twice. Is it Latham? Is that how you say it?
It's Lapham.
Lapham. Okay. That was the third way. All right, we got it right this time. And let's go into, I'm looking at the clock. This is starting to go quickly by. I just read an article, in fact, a series of articles about the reappearance of Ayn Rand, as her followers like to call her, Ayn Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged, to the point where people like the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, Koch brothers and others are financing the distribution of her novel Atlas Shrugged, a horrid piece of prose, which I could never understand its popularity. But in any event, that these corporate interests are penetrating her novel, Atlas Shrugged, into massively into the school systems around the country, including universities. What is their interest in Atlas Shrugged and Ayn Rand? And you mentioned it a considerable number of times in The Self-Made Myth.
Yeah, you know, in The Self-Made Myth, we talk about, you know, when we go back and we trace the history of this narrative throughout our country, you know, really Atlas Shrugged, the novel written by Ayn Rand, is really, it's almost Horatio Alger on steroids. Because not only are the heroes in Ayn Rand's books responsible for their own success and well-being, but they're responsible for the success and well-being of the entire nation. We're essentially all riding on their coattails, and as her title suggests, Atlas is, of course, the Greek Titan who holds up the entire world on his shoulders. And this really is, when you hear a lot of rhetoric coming from those on the right about, you know, the job creators, that's who they're talking about. They're talking about Rand's Atlas, Rand's hero, in her novels. And the important thing we point out in the book is that Ayn Rand and Horatio Alger, for that matter, were novelists. They were fiction writers. They were writing stories based on the way they viewed the world. So when we came to discount this, when we came to deconstruct this myth, we interviewed real business leaders. So the people we're talking about, this is what business looks like on the ground in real life, not in the fictional imagination of a 1950s writer. And that's an important distinction to make, because once you see the way business works in the real world, it's very clear that public structures, you know, that investments in the common good play a major role in their business success. And if we're really going to lift up this nation, if we're really going to foster an era of renewed prosperity, we need to begin ending all the wasteful tax giveaways to the wealthy and using that money to invest in the infrastructure we all share as a nation, from a robust education system to, you know, the kind of courts and regulations that provide the stability and protection we all need.
Well, I guess it's a mystery to me, and not really, but I'll pose it like a mystery to me, why these billionaires like the Koch brothers and others would spend millions of dollars a year to distribute a novel that's more than a half a century old. What do they think will be the result of, I mean, well, obviously they want to influence people's concept, but are they just trying to make everybody think that they're really nice guys instead of, you know, the bad guys in the scenario?
Well, I think what it goes to is that they recognize that the self-made myth serves a political agenda. They recognize the more they can tell people that the success of those at the top is entirely because of their own work, which is the basic assertion of Ayn Rand's novel, then they can distort people's views on inequality and progressive taxation and the role of government. And so I think, you know, they're bankrolling. And James Allison's another one that's been doing a lot of funding of, he's been giving $2 million grants to universities to teach courses on capitalism with Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged as required reading. And 60 major universities and schools have already taken him up on that offer. And so, but they're not doing this out of benevolence. They're doing this because they recognize it serves a political agenda. It undermines investments in the common good. It justifies extreme inequality. And it really, in the end, in our view, it leads people to support public policies that are counterproductive to the kind of broadly shared prosperity we need.
You know, maybe this is a question I should have asked earlier, and it has to do with social and class mobility. I've often said that we have something closer to a caste system, that people that are born poor, stay middle class, if you're wealthy, you stay wealthy. We've talked a little about the latter part of that. But the idea that there is a lot of upward mobility is the part of the self-made myth, the title of your book. Am I being unfair or I guess inaccurate would be a better word, in saying that we have something closer to a caste system than a social structure that has class mobility upward?
No, I don't think you're being unfair at all. I think there is some truth to that. And I think what's important to know is, yeah, there is some social mobility, and social mobility being, of course, the ability of a person born to a low-income household to rise to middle or upper income in their lifetime. And conversely, someone born to a high-income household to fall back down. That's what sociologists refer to when they talk about this social mobility. But the thing is, when you look at the data, the U.S. actually has been social mobility in the U.S. has been declining for the last 20, 30 years, so that a person born now in low-income household has far less probability of rising up during their lifetime than someone born 30 years ago. And that's because we've been increasingly becoming a nation of haves and have-nots. And we need to turn the clock back. We need to go back to a time when wealth and income were a little more evenly distributed. And I think it's no coincidence that some of the most robust economic growth this nation has seen was in the 1950s and 60s, in that post-war period when wealth and income was much more equitably shared in this country.
You know, someone, and I see we're almost out of time, so I should get this in quickly. There may be somebody listening and saying, that doesn't make any sense. When I was, my first job in the 1970s, I made $2.35. And now my wife and I together make $75,000. And hey, look at that. That shows you I made this upward mobile success.
Well, you know, I think there are some people who've gone up, there's some people who've gone down, but I think by and large, most of middle class America has not seen a salary increase in about 20 something years. And the data supports that. Almost all the income growth we've seen as a nation has gone to that very narrow sliver at the top of our economy. The top 1%, the top 5%.
Well, also, too, as I said, that someone when they're 21 years old, 40 years ago, makes one thing, and now he and his wife together, you know, that's part of it. But we do have just a bit more, and that's good, because I don't want to leave this on a negative note. You actually have a degree of optimism about what we can do. I never did get into the fact that Bill Gates wrote one of the forewords. Where does your hope lie? Does it think that that people like Bill Gates Sr. and Jr. will act out of conscience, or is it something greater than that?
Well, I think the hope really comes from many factors. I mean, part of my hope comes from the dramatic increase of awareness that Occupy has brought us. But we've also seen more and more high wealth people, and not just Bill Gates. I mean, there's tons of people we profile in this book: Abigail Disney, Gunn Denhart, founder of Hannah Anderson, Nikhil Arora, founder of Back to the Roots, and all these business people who speak out and recognize that it is not in their interest even to have the kind of inequality we have in this nation, and that there's more and more people speaking out. And I would invite any of your listeners to visit the website, selfmademyth.org, and get involved. We have a book tour coming up, but we also have there's a place on there where a person can tell their story. If you're a business leader, if you're a business owner, and you agree with what we've been saying here, that business success relies hard work is important, no doubt, but so are the vast array of public investments. Tell your story. Write letters to the editor. Get involved. It's important that we change the narrative around wealth creation. Just like the Koch brothers recognize that if they can get people to buy into the self-made myth, we recognize that we need folks to realize the built-together reality.
Well, we're out of time. Sorry, Brian. There's the clock looking at me. Brian Miller, thank you so much. Along with Mike Lapham, he has written The Self-Made Myth and the Truth About How Government Helps Individuals and Businesses Succeed, selfmademyth.org, and peterwerby.com. Brian Miller, thanks a lot for joining me.
Thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Yeah. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. The Vietnam War, as that recedes from memory, one would think that it would be discarded along with all of what accompanied it. Its history, its anger, the protest, the support our troops part for that war. It stays with us for a lot of good reasons, and we continue to investigate that in order to learn about what is happening in our political and military situations today. Joining me is somebody who I've had the pleasure of interviewing two or three times before, at a minimum, certainly on his last two books, which were CNN's Tailwind Tale, Inside Vietnam's Last Great Myth, which is a story in and of itself. But the one that evoked the most controversy, in fact, when Jalene Jordan and I were doing a nationally syndicated radio show, we had our guest on for like a whole 3 hours, longer than any guest ever. And the book that he'd written at that time that was so controversial was The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. And it essentially said that the stories of Vietnam vets being spit upon, or soldiers returning from Vietnam and then were spat upon, were constructions of memory that hadn't actually occurred. And here, back, Jerry Lemke is back with another book which challenges our historic memory, or is it really historic myth? The book is called Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. And besides being an author, Jerry Lemke is a professor of sociology at the College of the Holy Cross and in Massachusetts, right? Jerry Lemke, welcome.
Right, good to be with you. Yes, I'm in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester, Mass, as they used to say. Looks like, what does it look like? Looks like Worcester or something like that, but but it's, everybody knows it's Worcester.
Yeah, right. Well, some people do.
Another book on Vietnam. Did I hit it, or are there some other reasons why are we revisiting this, particularly since you're not a professor of history or a professor of sociology? What's there that that tweaks your memory?
Well, the book is really more about American culture today, the post-Vietnam American culture today, how the war in Vietnam continues to play into our political culture. And you're right that it does. I mean, witness the Richard Blumenthal story of the last couple of weeks, him saying he was a Vietnam veteran when he was really not, and saying that he was spat on when he came home from Vietnam, when he had never gone to Vietnam.
Yeah, even physically assaulted, he said,
yeah,
at one point. Yeah.
And the way Vietnam played also in the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the whole support the troops, the jingoism, which you made reference to also, it really works against the backdrop that Americans, anti-war activists, were supposedly hostile to Vietnam veterans when they came home from the war. And, of course, kind of a central figure in that is Hanoi Jane, this image of the woman betrayal figure, who some people hold responsible for the loss of the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, I was surprised that Hanoi Jane, and if people that we have a wide range of ages listening to this radio station, so some people weren't even alive during the events of Vietnam. Others, of course, remember. Many, I'm sure, listeners, at least some, actually fought it. And you're a Vietnam vet, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, and you were, I didn't realize this, you were in the chaplain corps?
I was a chaplain's assistant, which is not in the chaplain's corps. I was assigned to an artillery unit, and I did, there was a chaplain's assistant school at that time, maybe there still is, and I went through that and then was assigned to a chaplain in Vietnam in 1969.
And did you see combat or the results
No.
of combat?
No. The chaplains are non-combatants themselves, and the chaplain's assistant is formally a combatant. We do carry weapons, but the chaplains I worked for wanted to avoid combat as much as I did, so we did.
Yeah. Well, tell us about this. I mean, Hanoi Jane, I remember, years and years ago, walking into what we called a vets bar, and all of them were very much opposed to the Vietnam War. I thought that they'd been used and abused by the government, lied to, and suddenly there's a big bumper sticker on their wall that says, Jane Fonda, traitor bitch.
Oh, my gosh.
And I thought, whoa, what's happening here? Where did this come from?
Well, there's a lot of that stuff around. The more popular bumper sticker around here reads, "I'm not Fonda Fonda." And a lot of that stuff actually came from Waterbury, Connecticut, in 1987 when Jane Fonda and Robert De Niro went there to film Stanley and Iris. Waterbury was used as a setting because it was a factory town, and the story is a factory town-based story. And there was a group of veterans there who did believe that Jane Fonda had betrayed POWs in Vietnam, and they wanted the town not to be used for her filming. And so they mounted quite an opposition to it. They were on national television. They were on the Mort Downey Show, who some of your listeners will remember. And they coined this bumper sticker. They didn't coin Hanoi Jane, but the bumper sticker, "I'm not Fonda Fonda," and a lot of other memorabilia that can now be found online.
Jerry Lemke, you seemed kind of taken aback when I mentioned that phrase to describe Jane Fonda. But in your book, Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal, isn't there a similar...
There's a lot, yes. And I quote that same bumper sticker that you mentioned, because a lot of the phrasing against Fonda is misogynist phrasing. A lot of sexualized imagery is used. There are urinal stickers with her image on those, for example, that some people have seen. So it's the sexual imagery is in designed to evoke the image of a female betrayal figure and the supposed animosity of Vietnam veterans for this one in particular, Hanoi Jane.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the cover of your book, with the title of that name, there is this shot of Jane Fonda, very young Jane Fonda,
yep,
as a real sex pot in Barbarella. And then beneath it is the infamous photo of her at a North Vietnamese artillery battery, which is probably what the origins of all the vet hostility towards her. And she, of course, has apologized for that.
Yes.
But still, she is sort of an iconographically represents what? I'm not even sure what. I mean, one person can't lose a war. And even if she was like the most horrible, terrible person in the world and did a traitorous thing, why did she loom so large?
Well, the combination of those two photos is really what that's about. I argue in the book that she's despised so strongly, not just for having betrayed the military mission, as some people believe she did, but that she really betrays something more basic, which is the centrality of masculinity in American political culture. Manhood is very wrapped up with military prowess and military service in the United States and in Western culture in general. And a lot of people believe, you know, I'm talking about academic people, writers, journalists believe that the loss of the war in Vietnam was taken as a blow to American manhood, and not just for veterans, not just for people who fought in the war and might feel that way, but that America and America's sense of itself as a military, you know, proficient power really took a blow in Vietnam because of our very sense of our ability to make war, our willingness to go to war, at the core of which lies our sense of ourselves as a nation of strong men and warriors, male warriors.
So the whole complex history, the military strategies, the enormous casualties on the part of the Vietnamese and the Indochinese, the U.S. casualties, all get kind of just distilled down into this one person. So we're not talking about the view of events through some complexity of what reality is, but as I said, really just this icon of it all, which...
Well, not supposedly on this point. I mean, Fonda did go to Hanoi in 1972, and she made radio broadcasts from Hanoi over Radio Hanoi. She was one of many American activists who did that. She was, by that time, 1972, some 350 other Americans had gone, and many of them made radio broadcasts in which they denounced the war, they criticized the war, the conduct of the war. And Fonda, however, is alleged in her broadcast to have encouraged GIs to defect, to go over to the other side, or if not to defect, to desert the military. And according to the people who hold her responsible for the loss of the war, those radio broadcasts demoralized U.S. fighters still in Vietnam. Thing I point out about that is that there were very few left in South Vietnam at that time, and there's no evidence that anybody, any Americans, ever heard those broadcasts.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, when did you leave the service in the Vietnam era?
I left in February of 1970.
Okay, so you wouldn't have been there
too early.
Yeah,
right. But you know, my experience does bear on that a little bit, because the radio broadcast from Hanoi, of course, went on all the time, long before Fonda was there. And supposedly, you know, GIs in Vietnam listened to other Americans broadcasting from Hanoi also. And I, 1969, I have no memory whatsoever even of knowing about broadcasts from Hanoi, much less ever having heard those. One of the ironies is that we did listen to pirate radio in Vietnam, that is radio broadcasts made by other GIs who were anti-war and who were anti-military, and those we heard. But one of the ways in which myths like Hanoi Jane play is that they put in place, you know, a different imagery, and they displace the truth. And the truth on that one is that lots of soldiers in Vietnam by 1969 were opposed to the war themselves and making their own anti-war broadcasts over pirate radio. So people can get a glimpse of that in the film Sir No Sir about the GI anti-war movement. So those are the kind of things that I'm more interested in the book, is how these myths work within popular culture and within political culture.
Jerry Lemke is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. He's written Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. Hanoi Jane, in this case, is what Jane Fonda is called by some veterans. Now, the imagery, though, that you take on also in your book, The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, is that there are these valiant soldiers and their families and real good Americans that support our troops regardless of the war. And then there are sort of this amorphous, maybe you could describe in the popular imagery, at least what this is trying to create, that are hostile to the GIs themselves. But that wasn't the case, certainly during the Vietnam era.
Right. There's no record, very, very thin, if any record at all, of anti-war people being hostile to soldiers or to Vietnam veterans. That's the image that Hanoi Jane is supposed to help project. And, of course, Fonda was not active even in the anti-war movement at all until about 1970. And so, you know, she wasn't much of a player at all. And then when she was very, very supportive of GIs and very supportive of veterans, and really went out of her way to be helpful, to help end the war, for sure, as many other people, you know, were about at that time, was, you know, the idea of, if you support the troops, support the soldiers, help bring them home, help end this war. And that's the kind of role that she was playing at that time.
Also, she, along with Donald Sutherland and other famous people, set up this traveling entertainment troupe called, its nicest phrase, Free the Army, FTA, which meant something else.
The Army slogan at that time was Fun, Travel, and Adventure, one of their recruiting slogans. And, yes, they set up this alternative to the Bob Hope Show, which was a traveling variety show that went around to military bases around the world and had been doing that since World War II. But Fonda, Sutherland, Holly Near, Jules Pfeiffer put together
an anti-war troop to do this, and they performed not on military bases because the military wouldn't allow them on bases, but they performed at nearby off-base sites and drew large audiences of GIs. Fonda was also involved in your Detroit listeners, you know, would be interested in knowing she was involved in the Winter Soldier hearings in Detroit in 1970-71. At which Vietnam veterans made testimony about atrocities that they had seen or heard about in Vietnam, and she helped create those kinds of forums for veterans to speak at.
Yeah, and the idea, of course, that anti-war protesters were hostile GIs just confounds history, which
confounds history and helps, yes, confounds, distorts, and helps erase the history. Again, the real story is that thousands of guys came home from Vietnam and joined the anti-war movement. And nowadays, most people have forgotten that. Students that I have at Holy Cross College, you know, none of them, even though some of them have fathers or uncles who were in Vietnam, they haven't heard of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. They haven't heard about that. But most of them have heard stories about veterans being spat on, or they've heard stories about Hanoi Jane. Common story, the common response I get when I tell story, when I say that I'm working on a book, because students will ask, what are you working on? I say, well, I'm working on a book about Hanoi Jane or Jane Fonda. First response always is, oh, yeah, my dad hates Jane Fonda. Or yeah, oh, yeah, my uncle hates Jane Fonda. And the story that she betrayed POWs in Vietnam, that got into one of my classes a few years ago, and I really begin the book first chapter with this story that one of my students who was an ROTC cadet came to class one day with an internet message that she had gotten from her ROTC commander that read, yes, Jane Fonda did kill someone. And it was a story that circulates virally on the internet about Fonda going to Hanoi, visiting POWs, being given little pieces of paper that they wanted her to take home to their family members. She gave those little pieces of paper, according to the story, to their guards, who then beat some of the prisoners until three of them died. So my student, who was an ROTC cadet, was understandably, you know, interested in this, concerned about this, and wanting to know if this was true. So it works, you know, not only in popular culture, but the Hanoi Jane image, this icon, this trope works also still within military culture.
Well, wait a minute, but it wasn't true. She didn't do that.
That story is not true, not even close to being true. The people quoted in that story, I'm sure many of your listeners have come across that story. The people supposedly who turned their little pieces of paper over to the guards named in the story say it didn't happen, and they're not great fans of Jane Fonda.
Well, let me, Jerry, before we run out of time, let me ask you a couple other questions. The book is Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. It's published by the University of Massachusetts Press, and there will be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. And if you've got questions about this or want to comment, you can, from that site, you can email me, and if Jerry wants, I'll send them on to him. Jerry Lemke.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Lemcke is the way you spell his name. Now, on the face of it, it does appear as though going to North Vietnam at a time when the United States was at war with this country, albeit undeclared and based on a whole set of lies, as we've come to find out, was an egregious act. Like, for instance, if I went to a Taliban-held area right now and sat, and of course, I'd only be aiming at drones now, right? But if I sat at an anti-aircraft battery the way she did in North Vietnam, people would think this is absolutely, I might as well wind up with, what was the guy, Taliban John?
Taliban John, yeah.
Yeah. So this sounds in many ways, I'm sure, to most listeners as a defense of Jane Fonda.
Well, in the context of the times, it was not nearly as interesting as it sounds now. When you and I would tell that story, many, as I said earlier, 350 some Americans had already gone to Hanoi. Many of them had done some of the same things that Fonda did. The sitting on the aircraft piece or standing beside it, it's not really clear, you know, what she was doing there. She was being taken around on a tour is why she was there, and she had the photograph taken, but she wasn't posing, as some people say that she was. And it was really not very interesting to the press at that time. I think you're right. If you went to Afghanistan today, it would probably be of greater interest to the press than Jane Fonda was at that time. It really was not. Her trip did make the news, but it was not a front page story. And her trip made the news because she was reporting on the bombing of U.S. dikes, irrigation dikes in Vietnam at that time. And that's why the news people were interested in her. So the story of the gun and visiting POWs, all of that stuff has become much more important as the years have gone by, which, again, is one of the earmarks, one of the hallmarks of a myth or a legend.
Well, one of the things that I think people probably don't know is that great sections of the American people, certainly of anti-war activists and many GIs, considered the Nixon administration their enemy and not the Vietnamese people, to the extent that here in Detroit there was a national organization created called the People's Peace Treaty that met with the Vietnamese and declared peace, that thought that the Nixon policies, which were an extension of the Johnson war policies, was absolutely wrong, was wound up killing 3 million Vietnamese, Indochinese, and destroyed their country. And so didn't see, I mean, I assume at the end of it all that Jane Fonda did not see the Vietnamese as our enemy.
Oh, that's true. That's correct. Certainly by that time. And I think what you're pointing out is that her view was very in step with the view that not only many Americans had at that time, but many prominent Americans had at that time. And we're quite angry at the Nixon administration for continuing to prosecute the war. So again, Fonda was not an outstanding figure.
Well, hey, before we're almost out of time, and
sure.
Excuse me for interrupting you, but you wrote a book. Well, you say it's actually not about Jane Fonda; it's about Hanoi Jane, which are separate entities. Has Jane Fonda seen this book?
Yeah, yes, she has, and she's blogged very favorably about the book. People can find that on her blog, she was on Larry King about a month ago and said some nice things about the book there. So it's not a biography of Jane Fonda. The listeners have to look someplace else for that. It is really a study of a trope, a myth, a legend. It's really a study of Hanoi Jane, much more than it is a study of Jane Fonda.
So in preparation for the book, you did not interview her?
I did not interview her, no. I have talked to her, but actually we talked more about my book, The Spitting Image, that came out in 1998. And when I told her I was working on a new book, she said, "What's it about?" And I said, "Hanoi Jane." And she paused and she said, "So it's not about me."
Well, she
I said, "Right," and she smiled and she said she liked that because there are enough books about Jane Fonda, she said.
Well, we had 60 seconds left. I assume that there's probably some people that are going to take me up in my offer to angrily respond to what you said. Do you have anything to say to the Vietnam vets or the descendants of them that aren't convinced by that she was anything other than this horrible person that was one of the big causes of the loss in Vietnam?
Well, I would love to hear from them. I would love to, be able to talk to them, exchange email messages with them. Love to hear their side. There's a lot of stuff here that's historically inconclusive. You know, there's room for debate, discussion, alternative points of view. I'm always inviting
people who might have information that I don't have to you know, to get in touch with me and to bring that kind of stuff to my attention. You know, for example, her broadcast. You know, did you hear? You know, your listener, did you hear Jane Fonda broadcast from Hanoi? I haven't found anybody yet. Credibly, who says that they heard her? I mean, people who say they heard her in 1968, you know, which is before she made the broadcast. But something like that. I mean, I can never say never.
All right. Well, I can give people the. In fact, we're completely out of time, so I should do this quickly. Yeah. You can write me, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. Website is .com, but at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and I will send them along to Jerry Lemke. The book is Hanoi Jane, just published by the University of Massachusetts Press. The subtitle is War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. A generation later, the controversy and the debate continues, and well, it should. Jerry Lemke, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Good to be with you again.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Rumors spreading around, you like to take the town. About to check outside the games. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you wanna go to that home out on the range. They got a lot of nice girls.
Most WRIF contests are open to legal U.S. residents at least 18 years old. Winners may win only one contest every 30 days or every 6 months for prizes worth $600 or more. Employees and their family of Greater Media Detroit, its advertising agencies, and other radio stations in the metro area may not participate. No purchase necessary. Prizes are not transferable, and rules are subject to change at any time. Complete rules are available online at WRIF.com.